Welcome, folks, to episode 3614 of the Survival Podcast. I'm really excited today. I have Molly Engelhart in the green room right now. I was first exposed to her last year at, I believe it was Exit and Build. It was either that or Greater Reset that John Bush was running. I was down there speaking as well. And I had never heard of Molly. And when I heard her story, I'm like, this lady is fire. I think I actually reached out a couple times and never heard back. And then last month we heard from her booking agent. She wanted to be on the show. And I was like, yeah, let's get this done. So I'll have her on in just a minute. We're going to be talking about regenerative agriculture. We're going to be talking about Molly's journey from vegan chef to somebody running a ranch in Texas. It's an exciting story. We're going to talk about how she was impacted, like many of us were, by draconian policies due to COVID. California becoming, in her notes, uninvestable, much like New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Illinois. I completely agree. I think it's going to be a fantastic discussion. And like I said, when I promoted this episode earlier this morning, this lady is fire, so strap in. You're about to hear truth bomb after truth bomb after truth bomb. Before we do that, though, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor today, number one today, is Above Phone. You know that your phone spies on you? You know that people that make the apps for your phone spy on you? Your carrier spies on you? That, like, all that happens? And, like, you don't have to worry about just the people spying on you. Like, literally anybody that wants to buy your data, they'll just sell it. You know, that's a thing. You can make it all go away with Above Phone. With Above Phone, you can have your own private ecosystem of apps, your own open source operating system. And if you need an app, like in the Play Store, that you just can't find something in the open ecosystem, no big deal. You basically make a jail. You stick that legacy app in there, and it only can do the things that it does when you let it out of jail. And when it's done doing it, you put it right back in jail. But Jack, I'll never be able to figure out these newfangled fancy folks. They will give you a one-hour free consultation walking you over transitioning from your legacy phone to the next generation of phones, Above Phone. Check them out today. And if you are an MSB member, you get $75 off everything at AbovePhone.com. Well, every phone at AbovePhone.com. I don't think they're going to give you $75 off a T-shirt. Anyway, with that, next up today is the Wealth Studying Podcast with John Pugliano. I have been working with John Pugliano since 2010. That's a long relationship in the world of podcasting. He's an excellent investment manager. He takes everything that he knows about investing and managing money. He puts it into about a once a week 15 to 20 minute podcast called the Wealth Studying Podcast, where you can learn to grow your wealth the way that you grow a garden. If you like the vibe that comes from things about acquiring and developing wealth, like from, let's say, the best-selling book, The Richest Man in Babylon, you're going to want to listen to John. He's old-school, conservative, hardcore investor. Check him out today. And he's a prepper, too, guys. He's a ham radio operator. So he is in our world. He's also, you know, full-on prepper when it comes to making sure he has the things he needs. Gardens, has a very similar background to my own, former military officer as well. Great dude. You can trust him 100% and his advice. With that, I'm excited to bring our special guest on right now, Molly Engelhart. Molly, how are you doing today?
I am doing great. I got four sicky wicky kids, so I'm a little tired. But other than that, I am doing totally great today.
I get it. We've got our grandkids here, and I've got a granddaughter down with some kind of funk, too. It's always a tough thing. But thank you for taking the time to be with us today.
Oh, I'm so honored to be here today. Thank you so much for having me.
When I heard you speak, I was like, what again? And it was just bang after bang after bang. I'm like, man, I had no idea your story. You had just really kind of gotten a lot of press because of who you were and what you had decided to do, I think, at that time. Can you kind of talk a little bit about your journey? I mean, if I get anything wrong, correct me, but you were like this high-end vegan chef restaurant owner in Cali. And at some point you're like, no, no more of this California stuff. And you left, and you also found a journey in the realm of regen ag, nutrition, et cetera. Can you kind of bring people up to speed on your story on that?
Yeah. So I was never vegan, like the didactic kind of, my mom was a vegan and my dad was a vegetarian. And so it was just kind of the way I was raised. Like, you know, it's not everybody that's good with guns is like a big gun advocate. Some were just raised in families with guns and they were able to, it was kind of like that. Like, I wasn't a big vegan advocate. I just was raised that way. It was what was normal for me. And I opened, my dad was really good friends with Woody Harrelson. And when they were doing their raw food thing, I opened a raw food ice cream, raw vegan ice cream. The market was a little narrow, so I expanded into vegan food as a whole.
Okay.
And I became really, really popular in Los Angeles and expanded over many years into five restaurants. And these are big 5,000 square feet, you know, full bar. I had a brewery on Sunset Boulevard. These are big, very successful restaurants. And through my journey, I was for surely indoctrinated. I went to Cal Arts. I grew up in Ithaca, New York. Like, I was fully indoctrinated into humans are a plague on the planet and we're like going to burn an aisle and it's all, you know, we're the problem. And so I for sure was in that mindset and I was, you know, drinking my oat milk lattes and driving my hybrid Lexus and thinking it was like my civic duty to buy this expensive Toyota Lexus hybrid and using my reusable bags and paper straws that just deteriorated in my mouth. And I thought I was doing the right thing, but I felt pretty apathetic. And in 2013, my brother went to New Zealand and he listened to this guy, Graham Sait, talk. And Graham Sait had a TED Talk at that time. So I listened to Graham Sait's TED Talk and it just destroyed everything I believed about the environment, everything that I had been understanding. And I realized that carbon is not a problem. Carbon is cycling all the time and that we are the keystone species on the planet. And it's our job to participate with nature. We are not outside of God and nature expressing, we are actually inside of it, and that the suffering is coming from us thinking we're separate. And he didn't say that. He just talked about carbon. Yeah. And then that was my realization. And then he also talked about food waste. And, you know, I'm here a vegan, like my whole life thinking I'm doing the right thing by eating vegetables. And then I find out that if we're really concerned about gas in the environment, like if that's really something that we're concerned about, I suspect we're not at all concerned about it, but it's a fear tactic and a control tactic. But if we were, methane would be what we would be concerned about. And the number one cause of methane is food waste. And we do absolutely nothing to control the food waste.
Agreed. And, you know, the methane claim about the cattle, isn't that unique that all of a sudden animals farting is a problem. But if we go back to, let's say, prior to European settlement in North America, we had an estimated 50 to 60 million buffalo running around and nobody was worried about it back then.
Yeah, 100%. But I was a restaurant owner having tons of food waste. So I wanted to make a difference in that area. Am I frozen for you?
Yeah, I was just about to ask the audience if you're froze. I'm gonna pull you out and bring you back in and see if that changes it. Nope, now that made it worse. Now you're dark.
I says I have internet and everything. I don't know.
I hear you just fine. It's just we don't see you.
So I decide that I need to get a farm to deal with all my food waste from the restaurant. That's so I didn't know what to take out of it, but that's what I took out of it. So I tried to buy a farm for multiple years and had a hard time. And when I finally did buy a farm and started farming, I quickly realized that there's no vegan food, that it's a crazy, crazy illusion, the vegan food. Like all of our food is grown with blood meal and bone meal and feather meal and chicken shit and cow poop coming out of the consolidated feedlot system. And I realized that calories in, calories out, nobody could grow a vegan diet and survive without massive amounts of equipment and other kinds of things. So I just started to, you know, first thing I'm breastfeeding my baby and I'm thinking, oh, I'm doing such a good job. My breast milk is gold. And then I'm feeding oat milk to my toddler and I'm thinking, well, wait, why is my cow's milk going to cause cancer, but my milk is gold? That doesn't make any kind of sense in any way, shape, or form. And so I started feeding the raw milk from my cow and on and on and on. And then one thing after another, but this is all happening. And then I'm thinking I should change my restaurants to regenerative agriculture. But then I'm thinking, well, I just got an offer for $25 million for my restaurant. So let me just take this money, hand it off. I did this good thing, and then move on to the next chapter of my life. And so I'm in a contract for $25 million. I'm thinking I'm going to retire and be a mom, and that's great. And they close us down for 2.5 years. No indoor dining for 2.5 years.
And that scuttled your sale then, right?
It scuttled my sale, and it had me close my restaurants one by one just because I couldn't make payroll. So I went from about to cash out from somewhere between 25 and 31 million, depending if I could reach these different markers, to turn around to that. So that was really a horrible, horrible experience. But I'm not a victim, and I really just decided that they are not going to control me, but whatever business I do next is going to be a business for now and a prep for later. And that's how I got to Sovereignty Ranch and what I'm doing here in Texas now. And I just closed my last two businesses in California on the 6th, and then it started burning, raining ash down on my husband while he's packing up, literally the following day. But I just closed my last two restaurants there this last week.
It was insane to me watching it all happen, living here in Texas, which is where you're at now, to watch California literally destroy their small businesses. And, you know, people hear 25 million and that sounds pretty big, but in the world of business in America, this is like a small family owned concern. And to be here and to, other than the first about 45 days, to be able to just go to a restaurant. And like, we didn't have people lining the streets, dying in the streets with paper Chinese guys walking around with propaganda films happening. Like, our life was as normal as it could have been under the circumstances of all the fear and the hate and the scare tactics that were going on. And then watch other people that, like, there was no reason your life couldn't have been like ours was. And I'm just wondering, not just how you were harmed, but how many businesses were destroyed?
Thousands and thousands and thousands. And it's just the beginning. Like, you don't even know. It's just the beginning, because I was a business doing, you know, $7 million per store, $5 million per store, in that range. And so I had some ability to go farther till, you know, last week, my last restaurants closed down. But other businesses were just closed immediately. But then there's businesses that closed during the pandemic. And Biden did this thing when he did the, some sort of recovery act. So restaurants that didn't stay open during the pandemic got more money, because the way they did the math was they took – so imagine they said, well, you'd be taking your 2019, 2018, 2017 sales and comparing it against 2020, 2021, 2022, and the difference, we're going to give you the difference. Like, whoever wrote this bill has never owned a business. Not like the difference in profit or the difference in expenses, the difference in top line sales. So those of us who stayed open, and then minus your PPP money and your ERC money. So those of us who stayed open and did what we were supposed to do and may have taken that PPP money, but just spent it in the way we were supposed to spend it on employees and stayed open, we didn't get anything. And people that closed down got more money, like millions of dollars more money. Well, that money's running out. So that gave those people that closed down because they were scared or whatever, I believe that they were getting paid for complying, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Those of us who stayed open got less money. There's no way you can do the math and not think that people that shut down, shuttered in place, took that PPP money, took that, and then they got extra money, that they were paid to comply. That is the reality of what happened. And so those restaurants have cash on hand that is letting them go longer than I went, but they are closing too. And this right now, it wasn't just, so it was COVID, and then it was the actor's strike, writer's strike, and now it's the fires.
Yeah.
LA can't take anymore. I'm sure that architects and engineers and carpenters are going to do really well in the next several years. But reality is everything else is going to do badly. And people are going to pull back on spending anywhere, because when you're living in a war zone, when it looks how it looks in California right now, nobody wants to spend any money because it feels so crazy uncertain. When you look outside and everything is burned to a crisp around you, you do not want to spend money. I'm talking to friends, they don't want to go outside. People that were super anti-maskers are wearing masks because it's so toxic outside right now. I know 17 people personally that lost their homes. 12,000 plus homes have been burned thus far. This is, I mean, we've never seen something at this scale as far as a wildfire in the United States, I don't believe has happened. Even the Paradise Fire was like 4,000 homes. Also, just as suspicious, all the Paradise Fire, Maui, and this is crazy suspicious. Crazy suspicious. Whenever forest fires don't burn the forest and do burn the houses, it's real suspicious. And most houses in California are stucco. I mean, it's hard to catch stucco on fire. It's not stucco. You put a torch to stucco, it doesn't just go up in a second.
Yeah, I think there's a ton of bad management practices. I had somebody on last week about that. And when I booked him, he actually put his guest app in back in like November. So it wasn't like it was for that. But he went through a ton of stuff about how poorly managed things are out there. I think, and I want to turn the corner into Regen Ag and what you're doing now, but while we're on California, I think this is a hot thing. I personally think places like the Palisades, et cetera, are going to be turned into like housing projects. Newsom's out saying they're going to remove all the red tape and not only, but he's making like all this red tape's a problem. It's like, well, then why is it there in the first place, dude? And I think what you're going to see is like this high density dream these people have come to fruition. There's estimates already of like half the people that live there are just going to sell their land and jet. And if they do that, then a lot of the other people will end up going too, because their neighbors are gone, whatever. And as they start changing the entire landscape of this place, that's not what those people spent all that money to be there for in the first place. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, if that's kind of where you think it'll go.
I think for sure we're going, you know, fast forward towards smart city kind of situation where everything is high density housing with restaurants and food down below and nobody needs to drive. And so I think for sure that's where we're going. And you can't do that when you have these historic, just like you can't do that in Lahaina when you have these families, historic families that have owned this land. But mostly indigenous and Japanese families that have owned this land for millennia, you're not going to have them selling their land so you can do your smart city in Lahaina. You're not going to have people that are historically owned in Palisades or in Altadena. And you know, Altadena is beautiful. I mean, everybody that's our people, a lot of them lived in Altadena because you could have goats, you could have chickens. It's like, that's the vibe, but you're close enough to LA to commute. You're right next to Pasadena. And it's a really nice and tight knit neighborhood. I have a dear girlfriend that has like a little homestead there and it did not burn down, but she can't go back because everything else is burned down. Like, but hers didn't burn because, you know, the regenerative agriculture, like that she's just has 1,000 fruit trees on this tiny little property. So the trees and no smart meter on her house. So the combination of no smart meter on her house and all the fruit trees, there wasn't a way for them to ignite it. In my opinion, the proverbial they.
I got you. Let's talk about, you know, when you decided to change your life. And I listened to a podcast a few months ago that you were on. And I'm not sure if this was like when you were still in California. I don't know if you had any kind of real homesteading going on yet there with the animals, or if it was after you moved to Texas. But you were telling a story. I guess you had kind of gotten away from the pure veganism, but you still had this like view of like the animals needed to not be killed unless it was absolutely necessary or whatever. And you're talking about this thing with ducks, and you got an unbalanced duck flock and what that resulted in. And I think that's an interesting thing for people to hear.
Yeah. So one of the things that led me to knowing that like we're not outside of nature and we can't control and do that is we were had ducks, and I was not letting my husband kill any animals on the land. And, you know, my poor husband, he's indigenous from Mexico. It seemed like a lunacy to him. So I had these ducks. We had a lot of boys and a lot of girls, and they were rescued ducks from who knows where, and they weren't laying a lot of eggs. So I bought these khaki Campbell ducks that were supposed to lay a lot of eggs, and I raised them up on my back porch in this big stock tank, and they're so cute, and I love them. And then they got to be teenagers, and I brought them out to the orchard, and it's sprinkling, and they're waddling to the weeds, and they're eating the weeds, and they're eating the snails on the citrus trees. And I'm like, look at me doing the regenerative agriculture thing. I'm so good. And then my husband calls me a few hours later at work because someone called him that speaks Spanish. And so they called him instead of me. And he was like, you're not going to be happy. I just got a bunch of photographs and all the ducks are dead. All the khaki Campbells. And I'm like, 20 ducks. And he's like, yeah, they got raped to death. And I'm like, raped to death? Like, and he sends me these videos and they're just still getting raped by the drakes. And I call my dad totally upset. And my dad's like, yeah, that's enough to bring a vegan to her knees. And I tell my husband, like, make those ducks disappear. But nature nature doesn't allow for that. Ducks are territorial. And they'll have some girls and one male. The other males get pushed out. And they either survive as like a rogue male, or they are non-mating because they're controlled by the other males, or they're too young to mate, and then once they want to mate, they get pushed out. That's, or they take over the dominant male, and the dominant male is pushed out. But there's no circumstance where there's like 20 girls and 20 boys, or in this case, it was like 20 boys and 40 girls. And but the new 20 girls were just young, and these ducks were so horned out and just like wanted to fuck, and so they killed them. And I was just so devastated. And the other big thing that shifted my mind about it is that the neighbor's dogs killed my entire flock of sheep. And we came out there and they had dug into their nighttime enclosure. They were grazing in the daytime and then they had a nighttime enclosure. These dogs had dug in and then they were too tired after killing all the sheep to dig themselves out. And they were just covered in blood, dead sheep and half dead sheep all around in the enclosure. And they're just like panting and they didn't even eat them. And my husband's like yelling, he's like, go get a gun, go this, go that. And he's like, call people, we need to harvest all this meat. It was a cold morning in California, and so everything, a lot of the meat was still fine. There was two that had to be discarded, disposed of. But, and he spends all day harvesting 20 sheep, just cutting them up and everything. And he's like getting buckets and buckets, and he's telling me to call people. And all the white people that I call, they're like, oh no, we don't want meat with trauma in it. And I'm a vegetarian, and I'm thinking to myself, what do they mean? Do they think there's no trauma when they move animals to like a slaughterhouse in a vehicle and then they come out and it smells like blood and then they're shot in the head? Like, I just don't know what they mean, no trauma, but I think getting killed by a predator is normal. And so I was like, thought that was so weird that all these people have this fantasy about the meat system, that these sheep that lived a totally good life and then got attacked by a dog, they were unwilling to eat any of those. But then everybody is unwilling. But then, so all the Latinos though in the neighborhood were coming by, we were handing out buckets and buckets. It's like, gracias para borrego, gracias, gracias. And it's like notorious. People still see me in the grocery store when I still lived there, and they'd be like, oh, senora, gracias para the borrego. Anytime, like everybody was so grateful, because think about, that was like hundreds of pounds of lamb. And this is, people lived for months on that meat. You know what I mean? 2 5-gallon buckets is a lot of lamb.
And yeah, it is.
If you buy a lamb chop at the store, it's like $30, something more. So this is like a lot of meat. And I thought it was crazy that the white people were like, oh, no, 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 no. And I thought, we're so disconnected. We're like completely out of our mind disconnected, but yet we're all still eating meat. And I thought, it's way, to me, it's super important to not let all this meat go to waste. And I was so grateful to my husband at that moment, like men doing what men do. He just like jumped into action, got the gun, or I went and got the gun, and then he's like shooting them, slitting their throats, hanging them up from the tractor, the forklifts, and just skinning them, skinning one after another. Another guy is cleaning all their guts. you'd think like, oh, there's 20 something sheep, we don't need to save the guts. But no, they're cleaning all the tripas, they're cleaning all of the things like that. And I thought, wow, this is really like men doing what men should do. And then I'm calling these friends of mine that are do like whatever work in the tech industry or whatever. And they're like, oh no, I don't want it because I had trauma. And I'm thinking, that's not a man. Like that's, I really had that thought, like this is not a man. And so in that, those two experiences, I realized like we are not outside of nature. And we have grown up having livestock, humanity. I mean, grown up, not me personally, but and livestock has a relationship with humanity and it benefits both the livestock and the humans. And for me to think, oh, well, I'm just never going to cull any drakes, that doesn't make any sense. And for me to think that nature is this like beautiful thing and nothing dies, that's like insanity. Nature is constantly consuming oneself. Everything is always dying and being reborn into some other form every moment of every second in nature. And I always say when I talk on podcasts and stuff, nature does not lie. So you can live in a city and be totally disconnected and someone could convince you that a boy can have a baby, but you ask my 7-year-old and she'll be like, no, only when the bull is in the pasture do any babies come.
Yeah.
The girls jump on each other when it's time for them to get pregnant, but the girls jumping on them doesn't make a baby. Only a boy and a girl can make my 7-year-old could tell you that, yeah. Right? And so it's nature doesn't lie. And so it took less than 6 months of me farming full time to realize that whatever I had been indoctrinated into was not true. And so that's how I started my journey. And that's how a vegan, successful vegan chef in Los Angeles becomes a cattle rancher in Texas.
So you're definitely working with these animals now and they're being used for meat. Are you now eating meat? Have you made that crossover too?
No, I want to make that crossover, but so I've not eaten meat my whole life.
No. Come here. I'll cook for you. We'll fix that shit right now.
Oh, my husband's literally a chef. Like we literally, yeah. I've been doing bone broth and like my husband will try to force me to taste little bits, but I have not been eating meat, but I'm not opposed to it. I just haven't gotten there yet. But I just did 18 days raw milk fast.
Okay. I was going to say, you're not vegan and you're vegetarian. Okay. Yeah. I can usually have reasonable conversations with vegetarians because you can develop a decent diet. If I can use milk, if I can use eggs, like if I can use things that are animal-based proteins, I can construct a decent diet, but I find true veganism to be a modern luxury because trying to do it without that, you can't. You can't. Like there, I have defied people, and I've been told they exist, but no one has taken my $1,000. I have $1,000 out to anybody that can show me an actual indigenous peoples that are vegan. They don't exist.
They don't. And PETA says that there's this group in Nepal, but they eat butter. So they don't eat animals, but they do eat butter. Yeah. I looked up their diet because I was like, there's no way.
No.
But they eat yak butter. And then a couple times a year, they do eat meat, but it's only on special like religious holidays or whatever. So that is not true. Well, and here's the thing. It's the craziest level of privilege to be vegan. Like we talk a lot, and not me or you, but people talk a lot about privilege. There's white privilege and American privilege and this privilege and that privilege, male privilege. So I just want to say to only eat. Carnivore diet is also a privilege. I'm not that just for the record, like any diet where you're so specific about what you eat, the level of opulence that exists in the food you have access to is in the top 0.1% of the world. Like that is the reality because, for example, when I married my husband the second time, the first time we got married here in the United States, and then once he got his papers, we went to Mexico and got married with his family and my family and everybody. And people were on the internet like, on Instagram and stuff, like, I hope they're making a nice vegan meal for you. And, you know, my mother-in-law lives in three block walls with a thatch roof and a hammock and an outdoor stove, right? And 60 of my family descended on her three block walls. Imagine I then told her that she had to make an all vegan meal for my family. That would be crazy. Like the craziest crazy. And the food was so hodgepodge because they were like, they had two chickens, so they killed those two chickens, and then they caught some fish, and then they had, you know, it was like they had some pork left over from whatever, and they took, so it was like tamales, but it was like there was some chicken tamales, some fish tamales, some veggie tamales for me, and then some pork tamales. But they like had to scour the whole community to get enough meat and protein and food to feed my 60-person family coming from America. And I remember my one friend, Ricardo, he's like, oh, I understand why people walk across the border when they live like this. And I literally was like, you see how everybody calls my mother-in-law Danya? She's like wealthy. She has three kids that live in America. Like this is her, she's not living in poverty. Like you are, this is like, she has running water. He's like, but she has to use a bucket to flush the toilet. And I was like, yeah, but she has running water. She has a television. She has a washing machine. Like she's balling over here. Like her life, like you, we can go walk in the village if you want to see what poverty looks like here. This is, she's wealthy here, but the juxtaposition was so crazy. People were like, oh, is there a Starbucks in this town? And I'm like,
oh.
There was not a road to my husband's village until 1991. There's definitively not a Starbucks.
No, I had a friend that bought a place down in Mexico and moved down there. He married a local and basically lived down there, and he came and told me to visit him. And his instructions were along the lines of, you know, go to Brownsville and cross the border and keep following the highway. Go to mile marker or whatever. Right there, make a right, take a bearing, and stay due west. And if you drive long enough through the desert, you'll find us.
Yeah.
And I was like, can we have somebody come meet me? Because I don't want to end up, like, lost in the middle of nowhere. Now, this is pre-GPS where you couldn't just drop me, like, coordinates to go to.
Right.
And so I know exactly – and I did go see him, and we had a pretty good time hunting mule deer down there too. So I know what you're talking about. It is amazing to me the way people are today with that, you know, is there a Starbucks here? I had a flashback when I was 19 years old in the Army. I used to hang out in a place called Cerro Azul in Panama. And I remember them making coffee, and it looked like a witch's cauldron with a giant tea bag and like a lever. And like, that was the greatest coffee I ever drank in my life. And it probably wasn't even ground. I think they just took the beans that were roasted and like just put them in this bag and dumped it in this cauldron with a flames going up under it all. And I'm thinking, like, the people you're talking about probably wouldn't drink that coffee. Like, is it safe? Well, they boiled the water, dude. I think it's going to be all right. You know, like, it's amazing to me how that happens. I've been to a lot of places around the world, and we live in a bubble of non-reality here in America. I think a lot of us, you know, you're pretty clear to articulate. It's not all of us, but in general, even us, when we go into like town or whatever, that is not the real world. Like where I live, this is real. Over there is like a place to go on like 2-hour vacation is what it really is to me.
Yeah. And we are so like disconnected from everything. And I mean, look at when the power, people die of the cold when the power goes out. Like, I can't imagine having a house that didn't have a wood source of heat. Like, it wouldn't occur to me. I never have lived in a house without a wood source of heat in my entire life. I mean, maybe for a few months I lived in an apartment in California. But the reality is I have a wood cook stove. I have a wood hot water heater. Like, I would not die if we didn't have electricity. Like it's just, I just wouldn't, like, I wouldn't die of cold. Like that's, I know how to do stuff. Like, but we are the last generation of people that know how to do stuff. It's insane. I know how to can and make sourdough bread and make jerky and dehydrate food. Like what? We don't know how to do anything anymore. No. And no. I don't understand how did it take just two generations for us to become completely inept at anything?
Yeah, I don't get it either. I'm in my 50s, and I have to constantly remind myself doing a show like this now 16 years. There are people listening to you that want to learn that didn't grow up with you with what you did. Where I went to high school, they still close the school on the first day of deer season. Everybody had a garden. There was no such thing as a farmer's market because anything you could grow there, you could never sell because either the person grew it themselves or their neighbor did and gave it to them. My grandmother canned. I learned how to can. She baked. I learned how to bake. I learned how to – I completely butchered my first deer when I was 13 years old, and I was kind of a weird kid, so like I enjoyed – like I got to butcher all the family's deer once I proved I could do it. I grew up fishing, hunting, foraging. I don't get how disconnected. I understand. I would totally expect growing up there if I had, let's say, this is central Pennsylvania. If I'd gone down to Philadelphia, I would have totally expected those people to know less about it, but not nothing.
But nothing.
Nothing. No idea. Like literally the meat, like you said, the meat in the cellophane wrapper, that's okay. But the meat from the deer that I harvested, that I worked like crazy, scouted, became very good at my craft and took that animal and earned the right to that nutrition. That's bad.
Yeah.
Like do you think all your cows were like massaged until they got old and when they fall over and died of a cardiac arrest, then they turned it into hamburger? Like, where do you think your meat comes from?
No, we're just so, you know, I have a dear friend. Do you know who Blanchard is? He has a podcast called Breaking the Culture on Sunday nights. It's live. And he's mostly talks about how black culture, he's black. He talks about black culture being used to degrade the culture as a whole. And he did a presentation here at one of my events, and he grew up in Sacramento and now he lives in Atlanta. And he came to me the next morning after the second night he was here. He's like, I had to walk these girls home to their tent. And he goes, I've never seen the stars. I mean, I've seen stars, but I couldn't believe, it looked like a movie. And I was like, oh yeah, dark skies, that you could see all the stars. But he's my age, at least 40 something, and never has seen the stars. Imagine, like, we are just completely disconnected from nature, and we exist in a very fragile way because of that. And when we talk about like what happens to if there's an EMP or there's a disruption in the supply chain or there's a disruption in the banking or there's a disruption in electricity, people will just die because they don't know what to do.
I don't know if you had moved here yet when we had what they called the big freeze here, when we got hit really hard and the grid shut down and what have you. And when things finally started to kind of move again, I went into town and I was at a QT. For those not from Texas, it's a giant convenience store. And I was literally watching people stand where they have the hot dog rollers, warming their hands over the hot dog roller. And I was like, I'm not going to kick somebody when they're down or anything. But man, I mean, if that's the level that you're at now, you now are going to a convenience store to warm up. And warming your hands over the godforsaken thing that this roller is cooking, taquitos and hot dogs that probably aren't fit for human consumption. Like, how far have we as beings fallen to get there?
No, I mean, I don't know. I was just thinking the other day, because it's been really cold here. We went through a lot of wood, more than we did last winter. And I just was saying to my husband, like, oh, we need to get more wood, and he's from the tropics, so preparing is not it's not in his nature as much as it's in mine. And he was like, we're not gonna have that many more cold days. And I was like, I'm a request. There's a down tree over there, there's a down tree over there, and I'm a request that you go chop those trees up and bring them to the porch where they are accessible to me, because God forbid, we don't know what's gonna happen. And I don't want to be out there with four babies and a chainsaw for some reason because I had to. So please have there be enough wood by the house that I can reach.
Yeah.
But, and you know, my house is big. It's like 7,000 square feet, because it was 5,000 square feet. And when we bought it, it was the dumbest house you ever met. It had 26 foot ceilings and just two bedrooms, one cupboard, one closet, the worst design ever. So but we had some issues with the air conditioning and because I divided the house in half. So there wasn't enough space for me to like put new ducting and everything. And so I just put a wood cook stove. There's a fireplace and a wood cook stove, and I put them across from each other in the downstairs area. So we don't actually have a heating system or a cooling system for that part of the house. It's cooling doesn't matter. It's a concrete house and it's on the second, the bottom story, and there's no sun. So it stays cool. And, but for the wintertime, I just have those two things. And people are like, that seems crazy that, and I was like, upstairs we have heat, and in the other downstairs bedrooms, there's heat. And if, you know, if it sometimes becomes a problem, but between the wood cook stove and the fireplace across from each other, the whole downstairs is way warmer than it is upstairs. And it's way better to use wood, and I can do that easily. And, you know, and we can cook last night. We cooked salmon and everything on the wood cook stove, eggs and rice and tea. And I love that. I love using the wood cook stove. And people that come visit, they just, the wood cook stove will be going and they'll just turn on the gas because they're like, well, I don't know. How do you adjust it? I'm like, you don't. You lift the pan based on.
Yeah. Yeah, tell me you've never even used a grill before when you ask me that question. You know, I mean like a charcoal grill or a wood burning grill. Can we talk a little bit about some regenerative food stuff? One of the things I had in my notes for you is the regenerative food loop and why that's essential to sustainable ag.
Well, the regenerative food as a whole system is the concept of treating the soil as the most important thing. And fundamentally, soil is the foundation of all of life. The microbiology in soil is, you know, 70% compatible with a healthy gut for humans. And all animals, there's some large percentage that it's compatible. And animals are meant to eat on dirt. And that's why, like, we have to supplement. A lot of vegans supplement B12 because they don't eat meat, but animals actually get the B12 from the soil, and in livestock operations where they're not eating off the soil, we have to supplement. So the foundation of all of life is the soil. And so treating the soil as if it is the most important thing is the concept of regenerative agriculture through animal integration, no till or low till, no chemicals, biodiversity, and cover crops. And that are the five main principles of regenerative agriculture. And I'm just really interested because I've seen the results, and like having areas of the farm where nothing would grow, or in California, we took over this whole farm where it was 0.0 whatever percent organic matter and nothing would grow. And in 5 years, we brought it to 20% organic matter and just this thriving, beautiful farm. It was devastating to have to sell it. But that is, it's not like, oh, drive a Tesla in 100 years, you're going to have some minuscule impact, which is not going to happen at all. But I'm just saying that concept. This is like in 2 years, in 1 year, in 3 years, you're going to have a massive impact. And that is the most important thing.
Yeah. And I believe that it's all but impossible to do on broad scale without animals. I think if you want to build 10 really great garden beds, you can if you make another 40 of them just to grow vegetation, do quite a bit with that. But if you want to start, if you're going to start talking about restoring acreage, we need to be looking at grazing systems. We need to be looking at savanna mimic systems. The most rapidly accumulating topsoil in the world is in savanna systems. If we go non-marine, if you look at things like mangrove systems and all and shallow water systems, they go faster. But if you pull out of the marine, there's nothing that even comes close to savannas. And so if we want to learn from nature, we want to emulate what nature's doing, and we need to build topsoil because we've devalued it into this inert. I consider modern ag to really be like a giant waterless version of hydroponics, right? You have this chemical on it, and it's just, you know, these primary nutrients, primary macros the plants need, and then we'll genetically modify the plants so we can handle the salt from pumping the aquifers dry. And it's insane when animals manage these systems in nature. When people say they want it to be natural, then go look at natural systems and tell me where this happens in nature without animals in the system. And there is no answer to that question other than you're right.
Yeah, there is nowhere, and people love to tell me about cover crops and alfalfa and whatever they want to tell me. And I'm like, yeah, go do it. So, and here's the thing, if somebody's not doing it in real life and they want to tell me about this study and that study and blah, 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 and here's the thing, I put out a similar, I said, somebody get me large scale veganic farming that was not something that got taken over after already being established of like a perennial. So like a vineyard or an orange grove that someone took over when it was already established and now they're just like mulching it every year. Sorry, like, okay, I'm saying you can do that veganic. But like a large scale veganic farming, show it to me. Show me that's not just perennials that were established prior to becoming veganic. It doesn't exist. And I have challenged anybody to show it to me and they have sent me like websites or whatever, but then it's like, oh, this farm is collecting bat guana or this farm is collecting sea guana. Okay. That's still, I get that that's veganic in their mind, but that's not on large scale. That's not going to happen. We're not collecting bat shit or collecting sea guana at scale. So,
well, and like those people have no historical understanding of anything if they're worried about ethics and morality, because most of the seabird guana comes from the Falkland Islands. And if you want to talk about imprisoning humanity and brutal conditions, if you go back and read the history there and how it started out actually with silver mining, and they had so much silver they didn't know what to do with it all, and all their slaves started dying, and they're pretty much we've tapped out the silver because they were using this really horrific method using mercury to refine the silver. And somebody's like, hey, what about those big rocky islands over there covered in seabird shit? And it was about the exact same time that they were coming to an epiphany that they, you know, this Malthusian concept, they can't provide enough food in Europe, specifically England and Ireland. And they started shipping barges of this seagull shit that was this ancient bird shit that had been on the island for hundreds, thousands of years back to Europe. And they were using just massive amounts of horrific slave labor to do it. But that's all okay because, you know, no animals were harmed in the creation of this nonsense.
I mean, it's look at China and the Uyghurs and all of our solar panels. And like, I mean, there's so many places where people are completely complicit in slave systems and then don't want any turkeys to be harmed. And here's the thing. I don't want turkeys to, I don't think animals should have shitty lives until we harvest them. I think that's fucked up. And I think that that's partially a centralization of our food system and not having local food systems and not having individuals know how to grow food. I you know, husband and wife came to my farm yesterday to get some raw milk and I asked them something. They said, oh, we haven't bought any meat in 7 years. And I said, good on you. And they said, you know, we buy pasta and grains and stuff like that. And, you know, now that we're found you for the milk, but we've just tried to do our own food. I just buy salt and spices. And we're so disconnected from that. And just 150 years ago, everybody was doing that. And so it's, but the abuse, what vegans should be fighting against, the abuse really comes down to the centralization. And the more they want their burgers that are impossible or whatever, it's more centralization of the food system. And the impossible burger, where do you think all the waste from the impossible burger and the the Beyond Meat burger goes? Where do you think the fiber, when they extract all that protein from plants, where do you think that fiber goes? I guarantee you it's going to a bovine with multiple stomachs. And so
it probably is. You gotta do something with it, right?
I guarantee you that every single Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat Burger is being subsidized by ground beef, because it is, I guarantee you, the waistline is going right into the food system.
Yeah, Baptized in Fire is saying the carnivore diet reduced my food waste significantly. And I would agree. Whenever I teach composting, people always ask about bokashi for like protein waste. And I'm like, we don't have any. I think bokashi is a fine composting method and it works, but we don't have any protein waste. There is no protein waste here. We eat it all, and anything that is left, I have two dogs. Like, there's no world in which I'm throwing protein. Bones get made into bone stock, and they get so boiled out that you can crumble them, and then the dogs eat those. What's left of that? Like, I don't really have a waste product from any animal product that we're consuming. Eggs, the shells either go into the worm farm or they go into the major compost system, right? Like, I don't really have, like, if there's a piece of cheese that got a little bit of mold on it, we cut the mold off and then we eat the cheese. I don't really have like a dairy waste stream. I don't really have a meat waste stream.
We do, but that's because we have a restaurant on the ranch and human beings that order food at a restaurant, even if I grew it all myself. It breaks my heart when you see, like, you grew the eggs, you grew the meat, you grew everything, you grew the sweet potatoes, and people order, like, six extra things just to taste everything and you
throw
away. But that's why we have a pork program here, because everything that the restaurant people throw away in the restaurant, I turn into bacon or sausage. But, you know, we feed our chickens meat. So we go to the local place wherever people take their not like a USDA facility, but the custom slaughter place that does the deer and, you know, the family cow and stuff like that. We get all of their offcuts that they would render out. And we feed that to our chickens on field or on garden, wherever they are. And then once they're done eating it all and the maggots get in it and they eat the maggots and everything, I flail mower it with the flail mower, grind it down to nothing. And then what do I have? I have chicken poop mixed with blood meal and bone meal.
You don't have a waste stream either, really. What you have is a resource stream.
I have a resource stream. So we actually go out and get more protein on purpose and bring it to the farm. I said I have full bars. Do you want to try to bring me back in, bring me out and bring me in again? I don't know what.
Yeah, what I can do is I can kick you from the studio and then just click the link I gave you and come back in and maybe it'll work.
Okay, we can try. See.
Okay, I'll try it. Let's see. I don't want to ban you. I want to kick you. I'll kick you. You'll be right back.
Okay.
And we'll wait for her to come back. But she's making I think I'm going to TM. That thing there, it's not a waste stream. It's a resource stream, or turn your resource stream into your waste stream into a resource stream. It worked. You're back. We can see you now.
Oh my God. But no, I love that. And I love that. So sure, grain is available some places. We also have a organic, mill in Barton Springs, and we get a lot of their mill wastes, and we feed that to the pigs and we feed that to the chickens, and so we get a human, organic, regenerative. But I'm all about resource streams that are local. And so people say, oh, what do you think is the best thing to feed your chickens? And I say whatever's locally available, and then subsidize it with a little bit of high protein layer for your layer chickens. But I don't know, because I don't know what's available in your area. It might be brewer's waste. It might be wheel waste. It might be restaurant scraps. Like, chickens will get fat on restaurant scraps. If you can go get restaurant scraps, and there's so many ways in which you can be regenerative to your community and keep stuff. And any food that stays out of the landfill is huge. Like, people want to scream about carbon, but like I said, I think we should scream about food going into the waste stream, because that's a degenerative system. And when we can just turn it back into humus, that is a regenerative system. And we all can do that in our own areas. We have worms, we have chickens, we have pigs, we have everything to do that. But even if you just have chickens, I have a girlfriend, the one that lives in Altadena, she has chickens. She puts it on Craigslist that you could drop off your compost on her front porch, and she feeds all her compost, like neighbors and other people's compost, to her worms and her chickens. And she just buys a little bit of layer that she sprouts. She does like a whole grain layer and she sprouts it for them. And then she gives them, but you know, her husband did not want to spend a lot on the chicken feed. And
you don't want expensive pets. You want a livestock animal that's a resource and an asset. And the whole thing, like, whenever you see something about chicken or eggs and it's like 100% vegetarian fed, that's code for locked in a cage. Because you know very well, if you turn a chicken loose and there's grasshoppers in the field and there's a pile of their favorite, you know, chicken feed, they're going to the grasshopper first. Like, that's a priority.
They're going for deer guts.
Something that's protein, you throw like a piece of meat out, it's a chicken fight.
Oh, yeah. They'll go crazy over deer guts, deer heads, brains of cows. I mean, my husband is Mexican, and so we eat the heads of our cows. But, you know, at the USDA facility, you can't keep the head. So if I bring a cow to USDA, for custom slaughter, you can keep the head.
Yeah.
Because for you. So.
Yeah.
If I bring, but so we had a bull kill our hard lesson for my oldest adopted son 2 weeks ago. We got a bull from a neighbor and he put him in. My husband told him specifically where to put him and he was cleaning the pens. And for whatever reason, he put him in with these other cows and the two horses. And this bull killed my daughter's horse, flipped it over and killed it. And so my husband in his tradition, thinks that he needs to eat the feet and the head of his enemy, the bull. And so we asked, so when we took it to be harvested, they were like, oh, well, can't, it has to be custom. You can't do it USDA, but we can do it custom for you.
Okay.
And so then we had tacos de cabeza for dinner and then I don't know what he's going to do with the feet, but something.
I'm pretty big on the cheek. The beef cheek is one of the most amazing cuts that there is. It's incredible.
Yeah. And everybody is not a fan of tacos de cabeza, but I think the beef cheek by itself, but with the tacos de cabeza, they chop up everything.
So okay.
It's like
I'm
brain.
I'm not eating brain, you know.
It's brain and eyeball and cheek and nose and everything all mixed together and seasoned and whatever. But that also makes awesome bone broth because there's so much collagen in the brain, so much cholesterol in the brain. But anyways, so I say that to say we get tons of cow heads because people don't eat them. But the chickens will just eat out their eyeballs, everything, and love it and give you thousands of eggs. And that's a free resource for me. And then I'm doing a favor to the butcher because he has to pay to have that removed and rendered for him. So it's really a win-win-win. But our culture around meat is very different than – for example, my husband's culture, and I assume many other cultures around the world, we can't keep like the guts or any of that stuff when it's USDA. My husband was raised like always cleaning all the guts, cleaning the stomach, and eating all those parts of the animal for menudo or other things. But they don't let us keep it here.
Yeah, I mean, we don't eat enough organ meats in this country as well. And we're kind of spoiled because we have all these fattened cows that have a lot of fat on them for being fed corn in their last six miserable weeks out of CAFO. If you want to finish a cow, and you know this because you do this, but if you want to finish a cow till it really has the right fat amount on it before slaughter, you're going to spend another 6 months, 9 months finishing that animal versus stuffing it with corn at the end. And if you fed that animal the amount of grain that they feed it for those roughly 6 weeks on average for its whole life, it would die.
Yes.
It can't live on that diet. That's what people understand. It's like, it's kind of like making like goose pate where you got to like force feed the goose right at the end. Because if you did that the whole life, the goose's liver would blow up. You're basically giving it cirrhosis.
We don't do it that way. We feed the cows. We don't do grass fed, grass finish. We get grain from the organic mill in up by Austin, and then we cook that grain and we feed them a supplemental organic grain, human grade grain that we're getting locally for very inexpensive. And then we supplement with that little bit of grain towards the end, but not in like a force feeding way, like in a, they're getting a little bit of extra grain all along. Actually, we're giving them a little bit of extra grain all along that they're even like my cows that are on pasture on the other property right now. We've been once or twice a week doing a little bit of that organic grain supplementing because we have access to it. And so that's why I think you really want to find those resources in your area and figure out ways that you could make it work with the resources that you have. And sometimes people say, well, what's the best livestock to start with? I mean, I didn't imagine I was going to be a pig farmer, but I got 100 pigs on the ground right now because we have the restaurant making food waste. And then I got this grain waste stream that's as well. And so because of that, pigs are the ideal. I can't feed that grain waste. I can't feed it to cows exclusively. They would die of sepsis or they would get big bloated stomach. So, I mean, the pigs can literally almost exclusively eat this. And it's different all the time. Sometimes it's bran, sometimes it's corn, sometimes it's quinoa. It's like whatever they're milling into flour. Sometimes it's rice.
Yeah.
And so it's all whatever doesn't go through the cleaning process. And so it's a diverse diet. It's not like just feeding them spent grain barley from a distillery or something. It has a lot of different stuff. But we can feed the animals pretty much exclusively the food waste from the kitchen at the restaurant and that grain. And that's why our pig program has expanded so much, because the turnaround time on pigs is really good.
It's fast. It was a big deal during World War II in Britain, where they had these pig clubs, and the farmers were literally forced to sell almost all their production. They could only keep certain things because the country needed food. And they had this program called pig clubs, and like two or three families would get together and they would get a piglet and they would raise this pig, and they did like tamarins and stuff like that, get really big in 6 to 8 months. And they would raise these pigs as a community. And then it would get processed by the butcher, and 50% of that pig had to, like, they got money for it. It had to be sold into the market so it could go to like London and feed people. But the other half would then get divided up against the families that fed it, and they fed them 100% on kitchen waste.
Yeah.
That's where the term slop the hogs really comes from.
And I had pigs in California too with Sage, and at the amount of Sage had so much more waste than we had pigs. And so it was very, very difficult, to not want to expand the program there, but we were having vegan restaurants and we just didn't have the space. But here I don't have as much waste because the restaurant is not as busy and it's new, and we had 5 restaurants there. So you can imagine, we didn't ever even collect the waste from all of the restaurants for the pigs. And so we fed the chickens that waste and everything. So we were California. That's the one beautiful thing, that we had so much waste streams. We had wood chips, we had spent grain, we had restaurant waste. There was so much to give. The way I got the soil up to 20% in such a short period of time was all of that waste streams. And when you're out here in the country, people don't tend to have as much stuff leaving their property. If you have horses or cows out here or wood chips, people don't even chip stuff. They just burn it. So we don't have as access to as much organic material here as we did in California.
Yeah, yeah. You also have gotten pretty big with cover crops, and this is an interesting thing to me. Last fall, I released a cover crop course that's really geared toward backyard gardeners and people up to like the size of like 1.5 acre market gardens. But I also drew a tremendous amount of information out of cutting edge stuff that's being done on more broad scale systems. And what I did was take that and break that down to where the person with a much smaller holding could make use of all this data that we've gotten from great people like Gabe Brown and Ray Archuleta and what have you. And to me, it was like kind of the missing link. I've been actively involved with making biochar and using that for a long time, and actively involved with bioreactor style compost. And when I started adding cover crops to what I was doing, and it became more than just, oh, well, the garden's done for the year, I'm going to throw some cereal rye on it. Like, when I started using these mixed cover crops, and then I started using interplantings with the primary crops during the growing season, everything was already working, but it was like throwing kerosene on a fire. Like, it just took off in an insane way.
Yeah, because the microbiology in the soil can only live, most of it, on a living root. Much of it lives on a dying something, right? But the majority lives on a living root. And so when we take a field and we leave it fallow and then plow it, we're killing so much of what is available. And so I think that it's so important. And these multi-species cover crops, if you just put cereal rye, only the microbiology that lives on cereal rye is going to be able to live. But when you put a 16 species, like what we have right now out on the fields freezing to death, hopefully it recovers.
Yeah.
That is going to be really powerful in the microbiology that it adds to the soil.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also really, it doesn't just help build topsoil. I think people don't get, like, when you have ground that's not growing anything, then it's actually, it has to be in decay. It cannot stay, it can't reach stasis. It has to have microbial activity going on. It has to have living root in the systems. That's one of the fundamentals of regenerative agriculture. But part of that is that you have this carbon pump going on. That plant is pulling carbon for its own use, yes, but it's also pushing carbon into the soil, and that is your organic matter, at least part of it, because it's not just like leave behind roots. It's also like all these critters that lived off the plant exudates, et cetera, and that died. Their organic, that's what we're, when we plow, we kill them all, and that's why plowing works for a time. But when you have that living root in the soil, you get things like when it rains, the water goes in instead of over and across. And it's amazing to me, as I was doing all the research for the course, I would find these images, I folded into it, where you have these riparian areas. It seemed like a great idea. And you have this, like, thousands and thousands of acres of plowed field growing corn and soy and bean, et cetera, right? And then you have these rivers that, even with this riparian strip, let's say 100 yards wide, are chocolate milk looking, which means all that nutrient, all that waste, all that organic matter went into that creek. The creek went to the Mississippi River, and it created a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. And it's all because that water can't get in, because it is totally unreasonable to think a 100-yard strip can absorb the runoff from 40,000 acres. That math, there is no engineer in the world that would tell you that math works. And I've literally got images of brown chocolate water blowing out the side of like a cutoff bank into the creeks. In that course, you put cover crops in, you manage them properly. And I'm not going to say a heroic rain event can't still cause damage, but that is so mitigated unless it's the most like some kind of superstorm or something. It becomes non-existent.
Yeah, in 2023, I want to say January, we had a massive storm in California, and I lost we lost chickens to drowning, all this stuff, but we didn't lose any trees. Literally the cover crops growing between my orchards just laid down flat and helped the water spread out. It didn't make these deep roots grooves, and all my neighbors lost trees, lost banks, lost all this stuff. And we did not, we had lots of, and the recovery was pretty quick. And so that is really an obvious thing. That even with, we got 18 inches of water in 24 hours, and there was like a foot of water running across the entire farm, propane tanks like floating away. And I mean, big, like the 1,000-gallon protein tanks floating away. But we didn't lose trees. We didn't have any deep, the only place we lost soil and we lost, got those big grooves in the land was on the roads, because the roads had no cover crops. Yep. And so in the roads, the water could not infiltrate. And in that, we lost tons of soil, topsoil, but that was just the roads. And all that was left was the rocks in the roads. And then the city came, California and all their genius, they came and collected up all the silt off the road and like was with a snowplow. And then they took it away. And I was like, yo, can I have it back? It's from my road. Yeah. It's from my road. Can I put it back? And they're like, no, we have a contract to bring it to it. And then they were like, but you could call this number and you could pay for $100 a load. And I was like, no, just leave the fuck.
It's my dirt. I want the dirt back.
And so my husband's out there, like literally trying to get with the cat and the bulldozer and the bobcat and everything, trying to scrape up the dirt before the county comes and takes all the dirt.
It's idiocy. It really is. And you know, you mentioned carbon a few times, and I think we're on the same page. I'm not worried about, like, I'm not going to listen to a celebrity tell me that they're afraid the ocean is going to rise and destroy us all while they live in the most expensive shoreline properties on the planet. I'm done right there. I'm already done. I am big on, yes, I do want to take some carbon out of the atmosphere. And that is only because it's the only place I can get it. Carbon is a high level element. It cannot be made from lower elements anywhere than in like a fusion reactor, i.e. a star. The carbon we have on this planet is all the carbon that we're ever going to have. And so if I want more of it in the soil, I got to get it from somewhere. But I want it in the soil because it makes the entire system healthier. I'm not worried that we're all going to boil to death or whatever because of the air we exhale. But there's a huge role carbon plays in building rich topsoil, in moisture sequestration, in regenerative agriculture, and how we actually have this regenerative system. We have got to cycle carbon through that system, right?
Yeah. I mean, someone came at me crazy on Instagram because I said carbon is in the atmosphere and plants use water and sunlight.
Yeah.
And pull it down into their roots and make carbohydrates that feed the microbiology in the soil. And this person just got so mad and said, like, carbon and carbohydrates have nothing to do with each other, blah, 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 blah. And they were just, like, so upset. And I was just like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, I just don't know what to tell you. But carbon is not the problem. And I also – if you're rich and live at oceanfront property and you want to lecture me about carbon, I don't really care. But if you're unwilling to talk about geoengineering and chemicals in our water, food, and air, then I'm literally don't care what you have to say at all. Because if you think that carbon's a problem, but glyphosate and fluoride and atrazine are totally safe and effective, then we're not on the same page. So
yeah.
That to me, what I recognize is that the agenda that we're being sold only makes sense when you live in a city away from nature. Because if you watched Roundup being applied, which I do, I have a neighbor and I get to witness this beautiful clover that comes up every spring that he kills. And I'm like, I don't understand. You have 40 cows. Just graze the cows. He's like, what if they don't get it all? And I'm like, they'll get it all. Just strip graze them. Strip graze them, like super high density. Strip graze them. He sprays pre-emergence on an entire field of clover.
And then probably late in the summer when rain is low, buys hay.
No, it's a hay field. So he doesn't buy hay. But nice. But he's worried that, and I'm like, you're worried your Bermuda grass is not going to perform because of that clover? I promise you, Bermuda grass can perform with, and like, the only thing that can really compete with Bermuda grass maybe is mint, if you get the mint in when it's dormant. But clover cannot compete with Bermuda grass. Don't worry. Your invasive species of hay will be totally okay. But anyways, I say that to say, if you were to look out on this beautiful field of clover and then you watch it turn yellow overnight, you have to recognize how that is not okay for it to be in our food. And if you look at the studies with atrazine turning male frogs into fully functioning female frogs, I'm sorry, not okay. Like anything that turns one kind of frog, like anything that turns a frog from a male to a female, people are like, oh, well, good thing you're not a frog. I don't know. It is a good thing I'm not a frog. Thank you, God. But like, I don't understand if that level of chemical messing with that's happening is crazy.
Well, the level of denialism required to come up with that response. And the person you're talking about, you know, I said in the chat while you were doing is that you're triggered by seventh grade chemistry. This is seventh grade chemistry that this is what plants do. What is C6H12O6, right? If it's not a – what is it, right? I mean, can we at least be honest about the known science that we're talking about here and not get triggered by it? And I think the reason they blow up when you say something like that, it is this demonstrably fact. And then the brain is in this cognitive dissonance agony, and it cannot accept – what it just heard, because it defies the entire ethos of this person's life, even though they're not living in any way that's actually, even under their own twisted version, sustainable regenerative. They're not, right? These are the people that go to Starbucks every day for avocado toast, and then and you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm making my first coffee and setting the grinds aside for the worm farm, and I'm the one killing the planet.
Right. Exactly. Right? There is no
place that these two things could justify. So when you actually put it in front of them in a way that's simple to understand, it causes this brain like tantrum. It's like an adult brain tantrum, I guess.
My own cousin was like, I just don't understand how you could possibly believe that living the life you're living isn't exactly causing more harm to the planet than living in a city all condensed, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I don't understand how you could possibly think that your life, everything being trucked into you in bags, in plastic, in whatever, is somehow... And meanwhile, like I do sell, like we sell some greens in plastic. I don't like it, but like greens just wilt in like 2 seconds. Herbs we sell in the clamshells. But if I don't sell the herb clamshells, I don't throw those away with the herbs in them. I take all the herbs out, dry the herbs for tea or whatever, and then rinse them out and let them dry and refill them with new herbs. So I feel okay about that. But it's like, it's crazy to think that you live in a city and everything is trucked into you and everything is brought to you. And somehow that's more sustainable than living on land with 25 people or whatever and growing our own food and living in community. And we barely ever leave the ranch. Like that is the reality. I just want to say like we barely ever leave.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't leave here very often. And I only have 3 acres. It's pretty nice here. You know, like the one thing about COVID with the lockdowns or whatever, it's like, I'm going to go where I want anyway, but you don't really have to lock me down to keep me here. I'm pretty happy here. I hang out with my ducks and my geese and my dogs and my gardens. And like, it's just, to me, it's a better way to live. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about connecting with restaurants and you kind of mentioned already, but I also want to like point out, like you were talking about getting into these waste streams to feed your livestock. I don't know if you're familiar with Billy Bond, but one of his pieces of advice is, don't tell these people exactly what you're doing. Tell them the sordid truth. And so he feeds pigs and chickens and with waste streams from like university cafeterias and stuff like that. And what he tells everybody is the truth, but not the whole truth. I'm using it to make compost. Right. And because he is using it to make compost because it goes to the chicken or the pig and the pig is part of a compost system.
Right.
Because there's a lot of these people that say, well, I can't if you're going to feed it to animals. And once you tell them like, they'll never, because we tried that too, connecting with some of the grocery stores and all that. Go, well, we can't do it for that. Well, what if I'm making compost? Oh, we can do that. And so I think that's kind of a hack, but you've actually tied in really well with restaurants and created this functional circular economy. Now, part of it is, I think at least one of these restaurants is yours, so you're going to do what you want to do. But are there any ways that people can tie in more to those types of systems?
I would say see how you can make it multiple, like mutually beneficial. Like we have I also get the coffee grounds from the local coffee shop to put into our blueberries and other things that need acidification. And we do a lot of different ways. But yeah, the big grocery stores won't give us anything. And the small grocery stores, Thursday morning you can go, but you're going to be fighting like 10 old farmers for bags of lettuce. So I try to create mutually beneficial relationships. So with the mill, they were not getting paid. They were just like getting it taken away originally. And I said, well, I just want you to know that the guy is selling it, that you're selling it to. So
yeah.
I'm happy to buy it from you guys as well.
Yes.
If you're struggling, then you should get part of that revenue.
Yes.
And so you want to make it mutually beneficial. And so obviously you don't want to pay top dollar for waste streams, but it might be with a restaurant like, hey, I'm growing these microgreens and blah, 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 blah. What if I brought you 5 pounds of microgreens every week? Or what if I brought you tomatoes every, like whatever it is that you have a lot of, I would love to participate in that way. And then I want it to be a win-win because it is a little bit of a pain in the ass for them to keep it, the waste out of the regular landfill system.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think people realize that. And now I will tell you some of the places you can get waste streams, not really for feeding animals, but for compost systems and what have you, like every coffee shop, they'll give you all the coffee grounds you want. I mean, like you don't even have to sell. Like I've literally gone into like even chain ones and gone, hey, can you guys save grinds? And like, wait a minute. And they just have it's heavy as crap because it's soaking wet. But, you know, they'll give you a hefty sack full of coffee grinds anytime you ask. So there's a lot of waste streams that can be tied into. And I think we need to do this more, because the alternative is people are literally buying in expensive inputs to try to grow healthier food and lower costs. This doesn't work. We have to use the things that are sitting right there that are either really inexpensive or available for free.
Yeah. And that's a mind shift with everything. I mean, and you're always, we're with the restaurant here on the ranch, we're making a lot of the skim milk ricotta because we make cream, and I don't really love the skim milk ricotta, but it's good in a cheesecake. It's good in a quiche. It's good in pizza or casseroles. So it's like, how do I use my mind to use this product, even my own waste products, and have them be turning that trash to cash? So it's just, you just have to try to look at your own ecosystem. How can I turn trash to cash? And then look at the ecosystem around you and say, what trash is out there that could turn to cash for me? And those are the ways that I think it's important. And we never fed meat to our chickens in California. This is a whole new thing, but yeah. I was really looking around, what are the waste streams here? And then I was seeing these barrels of rotting, what occurred as rotting meat to me in the cooler at the custom slaughter. And they said, oh, we're waiting for them to get picked up to be rendered. And I was like, do they pay for them? And he was like, no, we pay $50 a barrel. And I was like, I will take some of those.
Yeah. Yeah. When somebody's paying to remove a waste stream and you can take it away for free. We do that with the production of biochar. I have several cabinet makers that are in my area, and I gave them big, like blue 50 gallon barrels. And when they're all full, they call me, I drive out, I throw them in the back of the truck, and I replace the barrels with empty barrels.
Yeah.
And I have this perfect feedstock for my biochar operation, and they have to haul it away themselves to the dump, or they have to burn it, and then it's just a waste product. It goes fully consumed, or they have to pay somebody to come get it. Those are their three choices. None of those are in the best interest of somebody whose job is to make beautiful cabinets.
Right.
What is in the best interest is somebody else takes it away and does something good with it. You don't have to do anything except what you were already doing. Throw it in a container and then call when it's full and I'll come get it. And all these guys are within like 5 miles of me. And so I think that's the other thing, is like, tie into the waste stream that's available where you are, because somebody out there is going to be like, well, I don't have anything like that. Do you not really? Like, if you want to feed your animals and maybe you don't want to really feed them brewer's grain, can you feed the brewer's grain to black soldier flies and spill the black soldier fly larva to that animal and then kind of upcycle the nutrient value of it and then take the frost from the black soldier flies, give it to the red wigglers, and then put that in your garden and grow more food? Like, all of these things are doable. And when you say that, again, everybody always wants to get down to, but I don't have that. First of all, make sure you don't before you say that. But what do you have? What are your tools? So it's like, I'm always on my grandchildren whenever they're stuck on something. What tools do you have? Emotionally, mentally, physically, what are your tools that are available for this problem? And that's something we haven't taught. And I think we've literally taught it, trained it out of people. Like, when people go to school today, the concept is the teacher knows the answer. The answer's in the back of the book. There's one right answer. And you need to be, not only do you need to get that answer, you need the approval of somebody else that says, thou did good, right? You need the recognition of that. And so I've hired some of these people when I used to still run companies with employees in it. And you give them something to do, and they'll work hard. They'll do the thing. But as soon as they're done, they just sit there. They don't self-act. And I realized after a while of complaining about it, I have to train them because they've been trained not to.
Yeah.
And I think the whole human race. And so there's a word that we use when we talk about animals that I think is being applied to humans. And my dad used to say this, and I used to think he was crazy. Domestication. We are being, as a species, domesticated to our handlers. And we are supposed to be a feral being, right? Well, I want my grandkids to be feral. My grandson's out doing some crazy shit right now. Good, right? He must have got his schoolwork done and my wife cut him loose. Like, I want them out there running around. I want them playing with stuff. If they get a scrape or a bump, they'll learn, right? As long as he doesn't kill himself or put himself in a wheelchair, go nuts, buddy. Don't bleed on the carpet. Like, we've lost that. I don't know about you. When I grew up, like, when the lights came on, you went home, or you got to a friend's house and called and told mom where you were. Like, there was, like, you were gone all day. And if you went home too much, they gave you shit to do. Oh, you're bored here. Like, you never said that. 1982, if you said you were bored, you just got a chore list, like, this long, right? Like, this is the world of just 30, 40 years ago. This is like, you talk like this, being like, well, back in 1921. Like, we're not talking about that. We're talking about, like you said, one, two generations ago.
Yeah, and I want that same thing for my kids. And, you know, yesterday my husband yelled at my son because he asked him to go get wood. He's 5 years old. And he tried to use the tricycle as a cart. His little sister's, the one-year-old's tricycle, as a cart to not have to carry the thing. And it did not work. And my husband yelled at him. And I was like, honestly, like, I'm happy that he's trying to figure out an easier way than just he's 5 years old carrying one piece of wood at a time. You told him everybody has to bring in 10 pieces of wood before they can go upstairs. He was trying to figure out a way to make it easier. To me, it doesn't seem like worth yelling at him for. To me, he was, and in my husband's eyes, he was like playing and not doing the task. But to me, he was trying to find an easier way to do the task, which is that's thinking for himself. And I like that. So, but I do think we're just so indoctrinated, and it's even, you know, my kids are homeschooled and limited television, but you can't believe you're like, oh, don't watch cartoons, only watch a nature show or whatever. They're indoctrinating them everywhere. My son, you know, they're just telling him like the oceans are burning up and we're killing the planet. And I'm like, you can't watch anything. Like everything is indoctrinating them to think that we are the pestilence on the planet rather than we have dominion and we have failed in our role as the keystone species. And it's time for us to take that role back, like right now.
The keystone species thing that you keep bringing up is huge because there is like the number one lie sold to us that lets all the other lies happen is that we are somehow apart. Like we are like there's nature over there and humans over here. So if we want to preserve an area, no humans should touch it. It should be this, you know, wild resource that just sits there as a refuge and humans can't even like we can walk around the edge and look in, but don't go inside it. Like this is completely asinine. There is no species that's more native to this planet. Like, we're not the only one. They're all native. But I'm saying a squirrel or a deer or a buffalo is not more native to planet Earth than you or I are. We are part of this. We're here for a reason.
For sure. And we talk about indigenous wisdom. Like, we're all indigenous to somewhere. So it's a silly concept.
Yeah.
And you can't imagine if they were like, oh, these brown cows have the indigenous wisdom how to graze, but these white cows don't know how to graze. Like, it's just the craziest, like, ridiculousness ever. And we have the skill sets to do all these things, and it's in us. It's in us, and we are not separate, and we have not been separate. It's just in the last several hundred years that we've tried to disconnect from nature and think that we live separate from it. And that is the lie that all other lies are on top of. Because if we look at the earth and we say it's ours, it's we're divinely meant to be here and we're the keystone species and we are meant to have dominion over it, then you can't convince us that like me driving my car is destroying everything and blah 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 blah. So that is the really, really important thing is that we all remember that we belong here, that I actually want to do a course with Ray Archuleta called Dominion here on the ranch, where it's a combination of regenerative agriculture and biblical principles that lean into regenerative agriculture. And so we're talking about doing a weekend at some point, I don't know, in the spring or maybe the fall with Ray Archuleta. But I do think it's important that we are re-remembering that we do belong here, that we are meant to be here. And that will clear up a lot of the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. If you ever need assistance stacking bodies in a class that's on site, let me know. I'm pretty good at that.
I love that.
Yeah, I'm happy to promote anything that you guys are doing.
What state are you in? You're in Texas?
I am just north of Fort Worth. I'm nowhere. Like the best place to be in Texas is nowhere where like my address is Fort Worth, but I'm nowhere near Fort Worth because I'm unincorporated. So yeah. I have no laws, no rules, no nothing. Like the sheriff's department told me, if you're not cooking meth, we don't care what you do. No building permits, no codes. Like I can literally build another house on my property on the existing septic and there's nothing anybody can do about it. But I think you're down toward where John is. I think you're down like in the kind of central Bastrop area, aren't you?
No, I'm in Bandera, Kerr County, on the edge.
Oh, you're out west.
So I'm also in nowhere.
Yep. You can do what you want to. It's an amazing feeling, isn't it? Like when you go like, I'm going to put a shed in. What do I have to wait? No, I don't have to. Hey guys, come put my shed in. That's the whole freaking process. Weird adapting to it. Now I grew up with it, then lost it and went back to it. So I assimilated back into freedom pretty quickly.
I love that. That's why I moved to Texas. I mean, we had a fire on our ranch in California and like never were able to rebuild the barn. Never, never. We had already started building the barn before we had the fire, and it just continued and continued and continued. And we were unable, like we were trying to build this bigger barn. And then literally when our barn burned down, it just held up the process even more. We had to do this $60,000 remediation and soil tests and blah, 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 that just financially. So 5 years, we couldn't build a manufactured prefab metal Quonset hut, you know, just like one of those. If I wanted to build that here and I had the money in the bank to pay for it, it could be up in a week.
Like it's the only thing you'll wait on, and it's not about approval, it's just getting it done. Is if you want a slab foundation, you'll wait for somebody to pour it for a while right now because it's in short supply. But there is nobody to ask, there is nobody to beg. There's like nothing. I've had contractors do work for me on some remodels in my place because it's a pretty old, and honestly, it was a kind of janky. My house was built in 78. Interest rates were like 18%. So there was a shortcut taken everywhere you could at that time. And you have a contractor come out here, well, I could do this and that, but I'm going to have to put this new vent for your drain and like all of it. Do I need that? No, it'll work, but that's code. You tell them I'm unincorporated. They're like, oh, never mind that. Like instantly they're like, never mind. Okay. Nobody's going to come inspect. Nope. Never mind. Just I'll take it. So I don't need, no, you don't need it. Like this is like ridiculous that some of this stuff even exists. And what I've been advising people is find it if you can. That's great. We need people doing it. But the easiest answer is to find somewhere you can do what you want and go there. I mean, that's what you did in a nutshell.
Yes. And I understand staying and fighting, but honestly, California doesn't deserve my taxes. California doesn't deserve my attention. And I feel bad because my community there was lovely. But if it took me 5 years, here we built 3 manufactured homes. We have 7 tiny houses. We have 4 shipping container bedrooms, 40 beds on the property. I'm building a brewery right now. We have a restaurant with permitting. I mean, I have a liquor license. I have a restaurant. We did all that in a year and a half. I couldn't even get a permit for a prefab building in 3 years in California.
And well, you just laid out, you could do it a lifetime.
$70,000 into permitting a barn that I never built. And I built my whole restaurant here for $80,000. So how does that, like, add that up in your head and ask yourself, well, why do I want to stay there and fight? But what I do want to do, and what I do want to say to people that live in Texas and live in unincorporated other red states, is don't start to think we need to regulate. Don't start to be like, oh, there was this meth head on my street and his house burned up, and now I want there to be some regulations that they can't put manufactured homes on a blah, blah, blah. Because that is the beginning of the end. You may have to deal with a meth head on your street, and you may have to deal with some trash on your neighbor's property that you don't like how it looks. But that is the price you pay to be able to build what you want to build, to call and put the shed and just come put the shed. Now you start to be concerned about your neighbor's meth house, and you start being concerned about your neighbor's trash, well, before you know it, you're going to have a vent for this and a this for this and a this for this, and you can't do this without this kind of foundation. And look it up. Do more people die in Texas from, like, bad building codes? No. It's mostly unincorporated, and nobody's dying. There's not, like, millions of people dying from carbon monoxide or electrical fires. Like, it's just not. It's not. It's not. It's not.
Well, you know, you mentioned that it was about 2 or 3 years ago, Texas lifted the requirement that people that worked on construction, if they were putting in plumbing, had to be licensed plumbers. Now, I do think you still have to be a licensed plumber to, like, tie in to the water system, like that last tie-in. But it turns out that a normal person can learn how to run PEX and terminate it in about 5 minutes.
Yes.
And there was this wailing and gnashing of teeth about all the horrible things that were going to happen when this passed. And you know what happened? Nothing. It's amazing how many things we think that we need that you take it away and literally nothing.
I'll tell you what, less people's houses will freeze when the next big freeze, because everybody's going to use PEX because it's easier. And then, I mean, I don't know how to do copper, but I can do PEX and I can do PVC. So I can do whatever plumbing. I'm kind of a jack of all trades. I grew marijuana for many years, so I know a lot about air conditioning and pumps and sump pumps and all that, and irrigation. I farmed, I know. So I'm a little bit of a jack of all trades. And actually, contractors hate me because you cannot con me. And they love to tell you some old nonsense that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah,
and I'll be like, so explain this to me.
Yeah.
Like, my house here had all the ducting for the second air conditioner, but it had never been put in. The people just didn't get the money or whatever. I don't know what they did. But all the ducting was there, and the conduit for the copper pipe and everything was there, and the pad was there, and the guy was like, $5,000. And I was like, $5,000 for a 2.5-ton unit that all the ducting is already in, and there's no crane, there's no permits, you don't...
Yeah.
Can you explain it to me? And then he was like, basically what he said is, you live way the fuck out here and nobody works out here, and so that's how much I charge. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to buy it myself and fly the guy from California out, and that's going to be $2,300 total. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But people hate that I know how to do it. Or in the restaurant, someone will come in and they'll tell me some crazy thing about what has to happen with the cooler, walk-in cooler or something, and I'll be like, well, I think it's this. Can you just bypass the thermostat for right now and put it on a timer and order that part? And then if that doesn't work, we'll try your replace the whole compressor 7,000 thing. And so I think it's important for all of us to educate ourselves at least enough on basic air conditioning, plumbing, all of these things, so that when someone tells you some craziness, you are able to say, well, no, I think that I don't think that that sounds right, because I'm telling you the amount of cons that are happening in construction and that kind of thing is crazy.
Yeah. And I would add cars to that too. Like, cars are another place and they do it more to women than men, because they think that they're going to get away with it more with women and men. I have a friend, a very close friend, and we have this, like, we live for somebody telling us that they haven't done it yet, but they're being told that. Let me get on the phone with the person for you. Like, it's like a hobby of ours. We've actually thought of, like, joking around, like, we should create a company called, like, mypersonalasshole.com. And so you come to us, and whatever amount of money we save you, you give us like 10% of what we save you. Because I have literally taken things that were $3,500 for auto work down to $300 in a 5-minute phone conversation. And I see it happen all the time. What happens is, like, you have this single mom. She goes into the dealership. They tell her she needs like $3,000 worth of work on her car. She's like, I got to get to work. I need my car. She whips out the Amex or the Discover card and puts it, and then she's got debt for 10 years. On this, and it never needed to be done in the first place, or it could have been done another way. And I see that happen all the time. And I always tell people, get familiar with everything that's expensive to fix. Even if you don't know how to do it, know enough about it that you can't be taken advantage of like that, because it's rampant. When they try to do it with my wife, like, whenever she takes the car, and I always have her go first, and then she'll come talk to me, and I walk in, and like, it takes one or two times, and they see you walk in, and they just go, oh no. Like, they know it's coming, and it's rampant. It's rampant. I'll send my wife in to do something like that by herself just to see if they're going to do it, so I know if I want to deal with this company ever again.
Yeah. I just had a situation with a car where I told them, like, hey, it's your warranty thing. It's a diesel. Blah, blah. They said it wasn't. They didn't like my attitude, blah, blah, blah. That's another thing. Like, man, it's never about their attitude. So, and then I go, okay, well, I hire this other guy, and I'm like, look, here's the situation. And he's like, well, I like that guy. And I'm like, I like the guy too, but here's the situation. This is what I believe it is. This is what the code reader is saying it is.
Yeah.
And they just did this. Here's the paperwork for the work. I think it's a warranty issue.
Yeah.
He said, well, let me try these 2-3 things. Great. I pay him by the hour, whatever, $700 to try these couple other things. And then he calls the guy and he's like, squarely, this is your warranty thing. She needs to, I can do it, but it doesn't make sense for me to do something you've already done. And there's obviously something wrong with it. So, but I had to get like another mechanic to like prove that I was correct in this situation, which is annoying.
It is annoying. Let's kind of get back on track. We've been talking about,
off track.
You know, it's okay though. Regenerative practices, right? But what we're really talking about is natural, holistic family lifestyles and maybe how those two align so well with each other.
Well, I think like we were talking about with nature, it's like we want to feed, every mother wants to feed her kids the best quality food, whether she knows it or not or knows what that is. I don't think any mother wants to do harm to their kids. And so the idea of being able to grow your own food, the idea of being able to live this life where everything is homemade and we're making kimchi from scratch and we're making sourdough bread from scratch and we're making fruit leathers from scratch, that was really a dream of mine. And when I lived in LA and worked 100 hours a week at the restaurants, it seemed impossible. And then when I lost that big $25 to $31 million deal, it also seemed really impossible. And, you know, I remember in 2018, some of my New Year's resolutions is like, I don't want to eat takeout as much. I want to only eat 100% homemade bread. And they seemed crazy. It seemed like, I know it doesn't seem that crazy now, but in the lifestyle I was living, it seemed really hard to get there. And now we're 100% there. Like we grow almost all of our food and we get an Azure standard order once a month. And we go to Costco maybe twice a month to get supplemental things that we can't get from those two places. But we grow almost everything. We preserve almost everything. And that lifestyle is going to then lead you to want to care for the soil. You want to have more production the following year. You want everything to get better year over year. So I think both of those things obviously go hand in hand. And I also want to say that it seems really expensive and people feel like I can't do it because it's so expensive. There's so many different versions of ways that we can do this, but many of them are together. And so it's not expensive financially. It's expensive emotionally to be willing to possibly live in community with people, to share with people, to navigate other human beings. That's really where the expense is. But so many people want to live on land and so many people have money and want to live on land and so many people don't have money and want to live on land. And there's so many different ways that everybody can come together and do this. We should not think about it as like, I only can do this if I have a lot of money and I only can do this like in the future when I retire, because then your kids are already grown up. And I really think it's important to have our kids in the dirt right now, eating food of the dirt right now.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And a couple things come to mind with that. One is, if you wait till your kids are grown to do this, you're going to be older and it's a lot of work. And it's a lot of work initially. And if you set it up right, it actually becomes less work if you build efficient systems. And while your kids are growing up, they get to learn from all that. They get to emulate all that. They're going to go out and reproduce that. That's great. You also have a labor force as they get older that can be helpful in it. And as you transition into that, as your kids go out and start slaying their own dragons or what have you, you have now a systematized homestead that you can actually manage. You should be designing whatever you're designing. You should be designing it with the reality that we'll be old one day, probably sooner than we want to. I've said many times over the years, the days are long, but the years are short, right? Like, so fast. It's sometimes I wake up and go, am I really in my freaking 50s? Is this real? Like, yeah, I don't get it. The other thing is, Jay, you mentioned the kids. I know you're a proponent of big families. We have all these arguments about why we need to have less people. I find this to be insane. We have built our entire economy on the idea that there's more young people than old people. That's how Social Security works. It's a Ponzi scheme. But if we don't have enough people, then we start to lose so much from a standpoint of culture and health and happiness. But we also lose, like, there's that 1% of people that are the innovators. And when you reduce the total number, that 1% gets a lot smaller. How many people that can change the world do you want? And as many as possible, you know, at least for the better. And,
yeah.
And then you get this other crap, because we kind of beat this up, but I'll bring it in. Well, because the planet's going to die. There's too many humans. Like, this is nonsense.
It's total nonsense. And I didn't have my first kid until I was 37, and there was a chance I wouldn't have had any kids. And I've had 4 and adopted 1, so I have 5. Total. And I'm 46, and I hope I can have more, but only God knows that. I have a little baby right now. It's still breastfeeding. I just had a baby a year ago. So, but I think that is the blessing of, you know, being here on the planet. It's really our purpose. And anybody, I don't actually think you can truly be a grown up or an adult until you have to parent, until you have to give yourself to another being in that way. I want to say that I was just talking to one of my friends this morning who's 45, still wants to have kids, but makes decisions not that don't lead to that. Like that, and I was saying like that, you don't actually want to be a parent. Like, you want some fantasy that doesn't exist, and then you're going to keep chasing that fantasy, and then you're going to keep wanting that new, fresh, how it feels when you're first in love with someone and everything's so amazing, and when that goes away. But that's not life. That's not what it's like. And so you want to get like, but I think the greatest joy in life is not the butterflies in your stomach when you first start fucking somebody. The greatest joy in life is holding one's child, loving one's child, having that community with your family. That is the greatest joy of my life. And I think that we have guilted people. I think part of that original lie that we don't belong here is what has people having less children, because they think, oh, I don't want to mess up the planet with all of our messy children. But I think we need more children that are freedom minded, freedom thinking, don't tread on me, you know, and we're all indoctrinating our children. We're all indoctrinating our children, no matter how much you think like maybe you're not because you're somehow special. We are all indoctrinating your children. My 9-year-old said the other day, oh, I wish I could run the government so I could stop taking taxes, stop controlling the weather. And I was like, and I was like, well, we're all indoctrinating our children to believe whatever we believe, whether we want to think that or not. But we need more people that are not just succumbing to that system that you're talking about of go to school, be acknowledged, one answer. I tell my children I don't know all the time. And they're like, what do you mean you don't know? Grown-ups know things. I have no idea. Well, grandma believes this and grandpa believes this, and they're totally opposed to each other. You're right. Grandma Jean believes this thing and grandpa believes this thing. They both have reasons to believe that they are true. They both have evidence that they can present, and I am not smart enough to know which is the true answer. And I respect both of them, and I understand both of their views. And, you know, I think it's important for us to have that conversation that we don't know.
Yeah. I have that conversation with my grandson all the time, especially about things that can't be known. Like, he's been asking me more and more about religion, and I'm like, faith is personal. Faith is what you choose to believe, and you believe it based on how you feel and all the information that you have available. I can't tell you what to believe, because then you don't really believe it. You're just doing what I told you to. And I think, you know, he's 14. A kid that age is ready for that level of discussion on it. He really is. And, you know, you're getting into world. You have worlds where you can know a thing. You have those worlds where you believe a thing, and those are different. You know, you can be Gnostic to a thing, or you can be agnostic to a thing. That's not about faith. That's about knowledge. There's no way I can say that I know exactly what God is. I know what I believe about it, but that's a walk through faith. And that's something that's going to be different. Even if you say you believe the same thing, different people have different walks through that. And we can't, if we don't differentiate between what we believe and what we know, we can't be honest about what we know or what we don't know.
And I feel like my mother has been deep down the conspiracy rabbit hole for far longer than I have.
Okay.
And, And I felt for many years that I knew she was wrong. I knew that I remember when I stopped growing marijuana and I started an ice cream shop, a vegan ice cream shop. My mother was so mad. She says, "You're entering the system." And I was like, "What?" She's like, "I might as well become a drug dealer. Like, you're entering the system, you're selling sugar, you're everything packaging, like every scoop of ice cream comes in a plastic container. Like, how much money are you making growing marijuana? You literally are just like plastic bags at the end of the year to put the pot in, and like not that much garbage. You don't create that much garbage. This is, and you're creating a mass amount of wealth. This, there's no way that this is better for this. This is, you're entering the system, blah, blah, blah." I might as well have been becoming a drug dealer, except for that I was becoming not a drug dealer. And my mother was so disappointed, right? And like, my mother's squarely a flat earther. So we'll be watching like some nature show with the kids, and she'll be like, "Oh, they're being indoctrinated. Look at that round earth," right? And so my son was, that was the thing. And I said, "Well, grandpa believes it's round. Grandpa believes it's flat." And I was taught that it was round, and that is what I live in, that paradigm. Yeah. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. I had that exact same conversation. And that sounds crazy to say it out loud, but I would say that my mother was right about a lot of things, and I haven't dove into that like swimming pool. But I'll tell you that she was right about 5G. She was right about the smart meter. She was right about a lot of stuff that I thought, this woman is out of her mind. And then it turned out that she was correct. And so I have told my son, like, in my 40s, I know much less than I did in my 20s. I thought I knew everything in my 20s. And in my 40s, I don't know a lot. And I'm surprised all the time by how much I don't know. And so that is, you know, where we stand. But as human beings, we want to know everything, and then we want to separate ourselves from everybody that doesn't agree with us. And that is, does it make sense? This woman got mad at me this morning. I don't even like Elon Musk. I think Elon Musk wants to put chips in our head and blah, blah, blah. I don't believe that he's this freedom fighter that people are posing him to be. But I also don't think he's a Nazi. I think he has Asperger's, and I think
Come on now. Yeah, exactly.
He's a Zionist. Honestly, he's a Zionist. But and so I was like, I don't understand how he was a Zionist 2 weeks ago. And so I posted this thing. I said, 2 weeks ago, the right was calling him a Zionist, and today the left is calling him a Nazi. Can we all just like stop? There's enough to be upset about, like, the oligarchy. We don't have to be picking this stuff up. And people just, like, attacked me for that this morning. And I was thinking, like, we don't even want to have critical thinking anymore. We don't even want to have the inquiry. We just want to know something. And if it pushes up at all against our identity, we don't want to hear it. Yeah. And for me, I had to have major public transformation around my vegan – around veganism. I'm married to someone who's undocumented. I believe the border should be fully closed. I also believe that my life is what it is because a 16-year-old boy walked here from Mexico when he was a boy. I recognize that those two things might seem incongruent with each other. They're not. I'll tell you why. 100,000 people disappear. 100,000 men disappear on the border every single year. Women are raped every single day on the border. So if we care at all about humanity, we don't let the cartels run the border. The border is secure. It's just secured by the Mexican cartels. Not a single person is crossing. When you see those thousands of people, believe me, they are all paying to cross the border. So, do we have a labor issue in the United States? Yes. So should the U.S. make a work permit that costs $10,000 for 10 years. You can never become an American citizen. Even if you marry someone here, you do not become an American citizen. Maybe you wear an ankle monitor, I don't know. But after 10 years, you can renew one time or you can go home. You are not stuck here. You can go see your family on the holidays. You pay into Social Security and you pay into the system. Maybe you pay only a stipend into Social Security because you're not going to collect Social Security. And that $10,000, that's the minimum you're going to pay the cartels to cross. That's what a coyote costs. So why shouldn't we just have that pay to the government, fly from Mexico City into Dallet, Fort Worth, with your paperwork. Don't get raped. Don't disappear and pay your tax. It's like,
how about we make the employer? How about we make the employer pay the match, but don't make the individual pay their share since they're not going to get it. That would reduce the propensity for their cheaper labor right there. So I'm going to hire you instead. If there is somebody that wants to do the job, person can come and work. They're not a burden to society. Their contribution is still being made because they're never going to draw from it. And it's like, okay, so a redneck hippie duck farmer can come up with that solution listening to you in 30 seconds. So don't tell me these people in charge can't fix this. They don't want to fix it. There is no benefit to fixing it for them.
No, and it's a major place for us to argue with each other. And I'm someone who's like in the middle, right, traversing this. I'm married to someone who's undocumented. I was undocumented. He's now legal. And I lived in Los Angeles. I have a large undocumented community that I know. And if I'm honest, like everybody had paperwork when they worked for me. But if I'm honest, I know that people did not have papers. And if you work in hospitality, if you work in farming, if you work, and so people who want to be like, we don't have a labor issue, it's because you're not in hospitality, you're not in farming. And if you want to see the price of food go skyrocket, then stop all undocumented immigration. I think we have a labor issue, but it should be a managed labor issue. I think that the only labor that we have for hospitality and for farming is the H1B. Yeah, H1B and H1, the other one for hospitality. Yeah. But they're only for 6 months. By the time 6 months, it takes me 6 months to train someone, and then they got to go. It's seasonal. I don't understand. Farming in most states in the southern hemisphere and on the west is a year-round business. So I don't think it should be a six-month. Hospitality is a year-round business everywhere except for in certain places.
So you notice that the immigration was never a winning issue for the right as long as it was the way that you're describing it, even without it being fixed, even without the paperwork, even without the permit, right? Like, it was never a winning issue for the right until we started having people taking over airports because they didn't have a place to put them, until people were having their kids kicked out of school so illegals could live in the school, and they weren't hardworking people from south of the border coming here for a better life. They were from all over the world. Some of them were being flown in with an app, and it was stuck in your face that these people were getting all this money for free. They were getting housing for free. The average American, I don't think, gives a toss about the dude that came here and is working in construction or in a restaurant or on a farm. They don't care about, like, that guy's not bothering anybody. And those people, some of them, because of the issues you brought up with, it's if you go home, then how do you get back in? These people go 10 years without seeing their family, and they send 80% of their income back to their families in Mexico or Venezuela or whatever. They're the salt of the earth. They need a place to exist where they're not being taken advantage of. But we also, I want the border secure from our viewpoint, so that person can come in, because I don't think the average American will make that deal right now because they rightfully do not trust the government offering it.
I mean, I can understand that. I'm just saying that we should defund the cartels, because if you do that math, on $10,000 per person, and you look at all those people coming across, that's a huge amount of money. And that is crazy, crazy, crazy. And I would say that I have a unique perspective because I work in agriculture and I work in hospitality. I'm married to someone who is undocumented, but he feels the same way. He feels like, what the heck? I didn't even be able to like go to the bathroom with any privacy for however long because I was living in a studio apartment with 10 guys sleeping like sardines on the floor until I got my hands, and I had to pay back the money that I borrowed to come here. And so I lived, you know, completely like with no privacy, just like stacked it like sardines in this gross little apartment. And he said, and these people are getting hotel rooms in Madison Square Garden. Like, I don't understand. He's like, someone explain it to me. Cell phones and he's like, I came here with the shoes on my back, and you know, you get robbed when you're coming. Any money you take with you, you're getting robbed. So besides paying for the cartel to cross, you know, everyone gets robbed on the way. It's always like an accident that we somehow ran into these people, but everybody gets robbed. So you get here with absolutely nothing. And he's like, I don't understand. I was 16 years old with absolutely nothing in the world and had to find a way. And these people are just getting cell phones and vouchers and houses and condos. And he said, it doesn't make any sense. And he's always like, even when I was more indoctrinated the first time that Trump became president, he was saying, I don't understand from the American perspective, the wall makes sense. I don't understand why people think it's racist. It doesn't have anything to do with race.
The walls are not racially permeable.
No.
Right? Like a wall stops a white guy, a brown guy, a black guy, a red guy the same. It's a wall. Like it's not like, oh, okay, like there's a sensor, like it's like a Star Trek force field, and I come walking up to it, it goes, white guy, and it lets me through, and it's like, Hispanic percentage, 49%, yeah, and then like 52, nope, can't get in. Like, it doesn't work that way.
And the other thing I think that is unfair and doesn't work about the current system, which most people don't know, is most people think of people crossing as Mexicans. Well, the Mexican crossings are very low because there's no asylum for Mexico. We don't actually, there is no pathway. There is no way. So you're 100% undocumented if you're Mexican and you come in. And so that means you can be deported at any time. Yeah. All these people that are coming in from everywhere are
Honduras,
claiming
asylum. Guatemala, El Salvador, right? Yeah, well, not really as much anymore, but at one time.
El Salvador no longer, I don't think you can claim. Anymore. But Honduras, but even Haiti, all these places you can claim asylum, but Mexicans cannot claim asylum. So therefore there's no like legal pathway. So for example, someone comes here from Honduras right now, they're getting an ankle bracelet. They're getting a court date in whenever in the future.
3 years.
And they're like, let go, free, you're in here. I think Trump is changing that, but that's what it is currently. But there's no way that a Mexican can do that. A Mexican cannot get caught. They have to get passed, and then they're just fully undocumented. Well, I believe that we should prioritize Mexico, not because my husband's Mexican, but because it's our closest neighbor, and that we want Mexico to be financially stable and sound and having an amazing economy because they are our neighbors, just like we want Canada to be doing well. I think that it makes the most sense. They are our biggest buffer between Central America and us is Mexico. So I do think that we should prioritize the job giving to the Mexican community and then go and then Guatemala, Salvador, Honduras. But that's because I do think that we want our neighbors to be stable. I think that we should care about our immediate surroundings. If you live next door to a house and the dad dies and the mom gets on crack and the kids are, you know, wiling out, that brings the value of your whole house down. If the whole community supports that mom and everybody, she gets a new job and da da da, and someone helps with the kids, da da da, it's a totally different outcome. So in my opinion, we can have a positive effect on Mexico, and that we want to give jobs. We actually want the money. If money's leaving our country, we want it to be cycling to Mexico and then back this way rather than having it go to wherever else in the world. And that is my opinion. I spend a lot of time talking about the border, and I have a lot of thoughts about it. And I do think that most people don't think that much about it. They just are like, have an opinion one way or the other. I think that we have a shortage of labor, specifically a specific kind of labor. And I think that we should create a permit that makes sense for that. And I think that we should prioritize Mexico for that.
Well, there's a huge labor force there, and they're willing workers. And I've had them. I used to run a construction company many, many years ago, and the hardest working people I had were immigrant labor. And you're right about the living conditions because of that situation too. I remember I used to have one of my guys pick them up, but I went and picked them up one day because we had to pick them up. And so I pull up to this little ratty ass looking single wide trailer, and all six of my guys come out of there, and I'm like, all six of you live in there? And the guy's like, no, boss, like 12 of us live in there. And I'm like, wow. Like, and they worked harder than a lot of my American labor did. And
that's because there's no more survival. In America, we don't have a survival in America anymore. There is, the safety net is so strong that the level of survival doesn't exist. That the level, like, what level of survival does a 16-year-old boy have to be in to my husband to come here, walk here, borrow money from a neighbor, and come here at 16 years old to be what, to do what needs to be done for his family? What level of survival is that? And I'm great, as much as I think that the border should be secured, I'm grateful every day that he made that journey, because I have my four children, I have my husband, and even my adopted son was an unaccompanied minor that came from Guatemala during the first Trump administration. And he was one of my big red pill moments too, because he said he was treated so well and taken care of, and they found his real parents and all of that, you know. So the, all that stories of kids in cages and no soap and all that stuff was not true.
That's why the pictures were from the Obama administration.
Obama administration, right?
Or there was a protester that put their own kids in a cage in the street, and then they tight cropped it. Like, there was so much nonsense around that. We won't solve this issue today, but I think we could both agree that we could do better than we're doing. And we don't have to treat people like trash to have control of our border. We can have a systematic way for people to come here and contribute. And I think the average American, way more than 70%, would say, if they don't qualify for any welfare, right, if we're not gonna steal your money to give it to them, and they have to come here and work and earn a living, and especially, like you said, no citizenship, I think the average person would say, why would I object to this? And if you tell me because Americans would do the work if it paid better, no, they won't. Okay, some of this work, you don't, like, go do it for a day. Go do it for a day and then tell me that with a straight face when you have kids that won't eat fucking chicken because it has bones in it, right? If a person won't eat chicken because there's a bone in it, they're probably not going to get out and start picking oranges. They're not going to do that. They're not going to sit in the back, you know, scraping slop and doing dishes. I have a good friend that runs a restaurant that we go to a lot down in Fort Worth, and he said they're paying dishwashers $22 an hour, can't get people.
Yeah,
$22 an hour to wash dishes?
In L.A. too, right now, we were paying 18 something, 19 to wash dishes right when I closed my last two restaurants. And I want to know where – the other thing is, by giving these things that they're giving people crossing, we don't actually have – there's no drive for those people to go and work. I've never had a hard time in the years having restaurants getting a dishwasher, sure, getting that entry level. And we don't have it anymore. And during COVID, a lot of the old timers, like, went home. They were like, you know, forget this.
It ain't worth it.
It's not worth it. The dollar went way. It was only like 16, 14 pesos to the dollar at a certain point during the pandemic, and just wasn't worth it. And they had built a house back home. They hadn't seen their kids in 20 years. Like, a lot of people left. And so there was like this vacuum in the back of house in California. And I'm going to tell you what, there were all these supposed people flooding in. They were not flooding to California to work in restaurants. I can tell you that factually.
So you don't sound like a leftist, but when I listen to your background, I think you probably aligned more with the left than the right. And so I guess now you're, especially among vegans, you're an apostate. Like, that's way worse than me. I was always this way. You were one of them, and then you became one of me, right? So they get really mad about that. What was it for you where you really just said, this is non-reality? How did the left lose you? Because you were part of it.
Well, I would say that I had like I had an experience on mushrooms in my early 30s. Where I was taken through having an abortion that I had when I was younger that I never thought about. It was like, I treated it like a root canal. And I never thought about it. And I got taken through the whole experience. And basically this voice said, are you more intelligent than divine intelligence? Well, no. Okay. Well, do you think you know better than divine intelligence? Well, no. Do you think that you have the same view, like, is your view more narrow or more wide than divine intelligence? More narrow. And so through this journey on mushrooms, it was like super gnarly and basically showing the fabric of life. And that every time you have an abortion, it was like basically vacuuming a fetus out. But then there was all these threads of the threads of life, and it was changing the whole fabric. And it was so gnarly and bloody. And I was like, what do you want from me? And the voice said to never do that again, promise to never give money to it, never encourage anybody, and never do that again. And so I had silently and never told anybody made that commitment when I was 30 years old. So I was already pro-life secretly in my secret. And I got pregnant with my husband on a one-night stand. He was 13 years younger than me. He was undocumented. He didn't speak any English. We had nothing in common. We had no thread of commonality. And I knew I had promised God that that mother, father, child was the Holy Trinity, and that I would never get another abortion. And so I basically went into the restaurant, and the circumstances that night, my ex-husband that we slept together, my ex-husband came in and he was drinking. He spit in my face. I then ended up having a drink. He drove me home. I slept with him. And then I was like, please don't ever tell anybody this happened. I'm so sorry. It's so embarrassing. And then 2 weeks later, I'm pregnant. I go to the restaurant and I'm like, I'm going to need you to break up with your girlfriend at the host stand. And I'm so sorry. We have to get married because I promised God. And we got married and we didn't have anything in common, nothing, nothing, nothing in common. And we didn't even speak the same language, and I didn't speak Spanish and he didn't speak English. And we lost that baby 5 months later. And everybody's like, you're free. You're free. You get to go. You could get an annulment. You still have another month to get an annulment in California. And I'm thinking, God, why would you do this to me? Like, what would be the reason? And we had this big party at the restaurant. It was an Indian family from India. And it was our 50th wedding anniversary. And they asked us, the kitchen crew, to come out and be acknowledged. And we all came out. They clapped for us. And I said, oh, well, thank you for having your 50th wedding anniversary with us. What's the secret to 50 years of marriage? And they said, oh, well, we were an arranged marriage. Huh? We're always building for tomorrow and building for our family and building for our community. We're not in our own feelings of you used to be like this, or you did this and I did this. And that really hit me. And we went home and he said via Google text, Google Translate, maybe the baby arranged our marriage. And that was 12 years ago. And so we stayed married and we built something extraordinary. And so I knew I was pro-life. I had made that transition of like having that level of radical faith, which most people don't have anymore. But I was still very, very liberal. And I was so liberal that I thought my husband was liberal because he was brown, and brown people are all liberal. But come to find out, my husband's super conservative, like, and most Latinos are. So that was just
Catholic country in the world, other than maybe Italy, is Mexico.
Right. I know. And so I was completely blown away by the fact that my husband was a conservative. Like, oh, which I should have guessed, because when I said, like, I talked to God and mother, father, child, we can't have an abortion, he just said, okay, we agreed to get married. So I assume, like, I now, looking back, it seems obvious that he would have been conservative. But anyway, so then I moved to the country when I started my farm in California right after Trump had been elected the first time. And I had really made up that everybody that voted for Trump hated my husband, hated my children, saw them as anchor babies. And everybody had a Trump. I moved to the country and everybody had a Trump pen sign in their yard. And I thought, wow, everybody hates us. And then I come to find out, like, everybody cares about the same things that I care about, like homesteading, home birth, no vaccines, all these same things. And so I remember having a birthday party, my first birthday party at the farm, and my neighbor came and he said, oh my gosh, seems like all a lot of liberal people here. And I was like, oh yeah, I'm from LA, sorry. And he was like, okay, tell me what we can talk about. And I was like, well, just stick to like organic farming, homesteading, your home births, homeschooling, that's all on the table. He's like, okay, and stay away from. And I was like, guns and Trump, and and abortion. And he was like, okay, no guns, no Trump, no abortion. Got it. And he goes out into the party. And in that day, I realized, like, all these people, the things that they really care about is like not having poison in their food and they're eating organic food and
all of this stuff is the same from my community that I, my new community and my old community. But what happened to my old community during COVID is what I call my Tesla goddesses. All my Tesla goddesses who like were not vaccinating their children, homeschooling, eating their organic smoothies from Erewhon and whatever, just like succumbed to the fucking vaccine because they wanted to go to Cabo or because their husband is in the film industry and they had to, or because they're whatever, like whatever the reason. And I was so shocked.
Yeah.
And I was shocked and I thought, well, and then all of a sudden, I've never been vaccinated. My mom, deep down the conspiracy tunnel for a long time, like I said, I was never vaccinated. So there wasn't a chance in hell that I was going to take some experimental thing coming. There was no amount of propaganda that was going to convince me that that was a good idea. And I was literally like dug in, like if this means I can never eat at another restaurant again for the rest of my life and I can never fly. This is the thing that they were telling you, like you're never going to be able to fly. I called my mom like, mom, and my brother's like, I'm totally going to get the vaccine if we're never going to see mom again. And I was like, mom would not want you to get the vaccine to see you again. I called mom and she's like, hell no, don't get that thing. Even if you never see me again, that's okay. And so I was very sure that that was not of God and not what I wanted. And then I started to listen to other people because every voice that I had turned to in my drive to work or whatever, all these voices that I had trusted as being truthful, I could tell were totally lying because I knew that vaccines were not safe and effective. I knew the data. I knew that there'd never been a double blind placebo study. I was raised with that. And so all of a sudden, everybody was a liar. And then the only person that was talking the truth or what I viewed the truth to be around vaccines was Tucker Carlson. And I was like, that racist fuck. Like, how? I'm like, why does he have to be the patron saint of not getting the vaccine?
Yeah.
And then I start listening to him and he's talking about the rain, like the temperate rainforest of Maine being torn down for water, like some sort of water energy that's completely ridiculous. And I'm like, this racist guy is an environmentalist. What about that? And so then I'm like, and then he starts talking, and then he's talking about the Ohio and all the chemicals. And I'm like, well, he cares about the chemicals in the water. And then I realize, like, wait, what does the left have to offer me anymore? Literally just killing my babies, which I have already, and that as soon as
I'm not doing that anyway. So
I'm not doing that anyway. And when you realize that the racism thing, when you take away the racism thing, because I couldn't hear anything because like, my kids are brown, my husband's brown, and if you're race, so I was like this, like la 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 la. And so when you took away the racism thing, like, oh wait, all my neighbors are not racist, Tucker Carlson's not racist, Trump is not racist, and so all of those, and then, you know, my mom's been big on the MMS, which is the salt. Do you know about MMS? The salt, so it's the salt from chloride activated with citric acid, and it can cure like all types of things. Malaria is what the original thing that it cured. And then there's this guy, Jim Humboldt, who wrote a book that is banned on Amazon, but you can get it like used bookstores online. And it's amazing. It cures like everything. My kids, when they get sick, MMS bath right away. So I knew when Trump was talking about there's something like bleach that you can drink that kills the virus. Yeah. I knew he was talking about MMS. And I was like, oh my goodness, he is talking about MMS. And I was like, yeah, I bet MMS does cure COVID. And so I just, all of that stuff like just congealed. And I was like, wait, and I've always been anti-regulation. I'm a business owner. I've always been anti-taxation. And then I was always told that the Republicans wanted more taxes and more control and more oligarchy. But the Democrats were so oligarchy and controlling that I was like, nothing that I believe is true. I don't know anything. And then when I just looked at my own self, like I believe in family. I'm patriotic. I believe in our country. I believe the Constitution is an experiment worth fighting for. And all of those things were conservative values. And I just realized like I actually wasn't a liberal. I don't even know if I ever was a liberal. I do believe in caring for the earth, and but yeah, I a lot of the things I thought that I believed, I and obviously I don't think a boy can be a girl. When people were saying that, I was like, I don't understand what. And so all of those things just made it so obvious to me, and it was like the lie of COVID made every other lie. People, all the liberals just continued to lie. When it was
obvious, in a weird way, what went on with COVID is the best thing that's ever happened to us.
Yes.
In a weird way, like if you went back to 2019, I could push a button and make it not happen. Would I? I probably would, but maybe I shouldn't. Like sometimes the timeline does a thing that you don't understand until it comes to fruition. And there are so many people that you could not reach. You could not. When I first started kind of coming up in this space, I ended up being really well known within like the permaculture circles. I spoke at all kinds of conferences and stuff on how to do this stuff. And I would always have, it was younger people than me come to me to talk to me and think I was this evil, racist, militant, you know, destroyer of all things because I didn't believe in their global warming fantasy. And right. I honestly left it out of my talks. They would just know who I was and they would come talk to me. And instead of telling them how stupid they were, I'd like, well, explain it to me. And then I would go through, let me tell you what my life is like. I wake up and this is how I live my life. And this is how I manage my animals. I manage my farm. This is what I teach people to do. What do you want me to do differently? And they would all look at me and go, well, do? Oh, well, no, what you're doing is great. I'm like, so you're all worried about this carbon footprint. Be honest, is my carbon footprint smaller than yours? Well, yeah. So what do you want me to do? And what it would come down to, it's not what you're doing. It's what you're saying. And then, you know, these were usually college educated kids, so they did have some intelligence going on there. Okay, what do we call it? Because if you tell them, then you messed it up. You got to get them to say it. What do we call it when we judge somebody more on what they say than what we do? And eventually you'd lead them there to go, well, that's kind of like a religion. Ah, and religion is a fine thing. But should we have a religion to these things that are scientific? And then shut up. Don't say a word. Let them talk. Because what they get is that experience you had right there. They might not fully realize it at that point, but you create that crack in this diehard faith that these people have. And as soon as one piece falls, it just, the rest, it might take years, but it can't stay. It can't stand. It's impossible because you broke the foundation. And the reason I think the left is effective, and they are effective, is they take five or six at any given time hot button emotional issues, and they appeal the fuck out of those emotions on those sick things. And they know that the average person, if they listen to it and they're receptive to it, they'll pick one or two and they'll grab that. And that will drown everything out. Just like you were saying, I can't listen to these people because they're racist.
Right.
There's almost nothing in the world you can call somebody today that's more horrible than calling them a racist. And the reality is most people aren't. Most people just aren't, right? Like you could try to make the case that they are, but all you're really saying is, I don't like what you do, or I don't like what you say, or I don't like the way you present yourself, so I'm going to just take this label and stick it on you. But whether it's the abortion issue, whether it's racist, whether it's immigration, whatever it is, if they can make two or more plank in that person's head, until you break that, you cannot allow them to see for themselves. And they'll never listen to you. It has to be like you had it. It has to be an awakening, and you have to shut up and let them experience it.
And that's why people get so triggered by me, is because I'm telling the truth, and I'm telling the truth from a perspective of where I was and where I am. And I have people that are literally like harass me online, and maybe it was about the vegan thing at the beginning, but now it doesn't even matter. It's just like everything, they're harassing me constantly. And really why they're triggered by me, why they spend time every day, even though I've blocked them and I can not see them, but I can look like, oh my gosh, they've sent me 120 things, is because whatever I'm talking about is putting cracks in their thing, but their identity is so attached to this view. Their identity is so attached to global warming, and the science is settled on vaccines and all of these things, that they will just attack me. I mean, I got someone my kids were in a bounce house and I took some pictures and they were like, oh my goodness, you let your kids in a bounce house in the plastics and blah, 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 blah. You say you're a good mom, but you're not. And I'm like, oh Lord, like Like, you just need to find something to be upset about. And then if you're, and then, oh, you're so fat, you're so ugly, you're aging so poorly. If you, if the best thing that you could tell me is that I'm fat and I'm ugly and I'm aging poorly, you have lost an argument. Like, I literally just want to say that you have lost the argument, because if the argument is whether vaccines are safe and effective, or if that carbon is really causing everything that people believe it is, or if, you know, veganism is really the healthiest diet on the planet, like, if your argument and response is you're old and fat and ugly, I've won the argument, because literally, if you had something better to say, then you're, that's the same as calling you, they just can't call me racist. And some people did call me racist. I even had a guy calling my husband, like, saying you're colonized, something, something, like, oh, because he rides a horse, and he's like, oh, way to use the transportation of the colonizer. And then my husband was like, you sell soy curl tacos. Could you tell me what indigenous tribe is soy curl tacos? Like, I don't, could, and then he was like, and just so you know, there was no road to my village till 1991. My father never drove a car. He only drove a horse. And I'm far more indigenous than you, and you're selling vegan tacos in San Francisco. So I don't know what you're telling me. And then they were like, telling him he's like been colonized by me, and I'm just having him as a sex slave. And I'm like, wow, like, look how messed up your mind is, that you, because what I'm saying doesn't agree with your worldview so much, you need to make my relationship completely devalued and about race, because you can't agree with what I have to say. And that doesn't, it just doesn't make any sense. And but most people can't call me a racist in good conscience, and so they go to the your.
They gotta go to something else, right? They gotta attack you. And like I said, they hate me. They hate you more because I was never one of them. You were. It's a weird dynamic. Like, being an apostate is like the worst thing you can be. For the right, too, by the way. If you were formally conservative, right wing, and you were known for that, and you move into more like of a libertarian mindset, which I think is really where both of us are more coming from, then they get really angry about that too. Like, I mean, full on, I'm really at heart, I'm an anarchist. Like, I also am a realist though, and I believe that we don't live in a society ready for it yet. Like, I try to live as much as an anarchist as I can in my personal life, but then I realize that everybody else is relying on somebody to tell them what to do. And if I believe in true freedom, they have to have the freedom to do that too. If I want my freedom to not listen to somebody, I got to have to give you your freedom and an understanding you have that freedom to listen to whoever you want to. And if you want to do stupid things to yourself and you want somebody to control your life, it is not my place to stop it.
I know, but I feel concerned.
Oh, I do too. I didn't say I didn't feel concerned.
Enough, like, people that want a carbon footprint credit card, that who are these people that are signing up for – signing up for this, like, I don't know what it is, but like, to be in the test group for the carbon credit system. Like, who is doing that? I'm like wanting to resist with all of my power, and but people want to sign up to be in the system where people, where you're good, because people want to feel like they're good. And if you're and so my carbon footprint is blah blah blah. And I'm like, yeah, well, your electric car is blowing coal across the county over here. Just because you outsourced your pollution to a different county does not make it that there's zero emissions. That's just like zero local emissions. I don't understand. Or LA, banned drilling. We have tons of oil in LA. They banned drilling. And I was like, and people were celebrating this. And I was like, could someone explain to me why we're celebrating? LA has the most regulations, the most strict cleanup, the most strict everything. Why are we celebrating that there's no more drilling in LA, but we're letting them drill in the Amazon where the Achuar people live with far less restrictions and cleanup? And you're telling me that that is somehow a win for the environment. It's not a win for the environment. And unless you're going to stop using fossil fuels tomorrow, this idea that you're going to hold the fossil fuel companies to account, hold their feet to the fire, whatever people say that to me. And I'm like, explain
I hate that term.
Whose feet are we holding to the fire for what? Did you put gas in your car today? Oh, yeah. No, you have a Tesla, so you put coal in your car today. Okay, well, I don't understand how you think that you're less accountable than they are.
Yeah.
You are the supply chain. You are demanding it. You are the consumer demanding it.
Well, and for the people on the video, or I should say really for the audio, because you know, you can't see it, what I've got right now up on our screen with us is a picture of a rare earth element mine. This is where the rare earth elements that make the batteries for your Tesla or other electric vehicle come from. This is what it takes to make that. And for all of that material that was moved out of there, a very small percentage of it is actually the cadmium or the cobalt or whatever they're looking for, or the lithium. And all the rest of it is soaked in like the most destructive, nastiest chemicals on the planet. And there's these huge swaths of these giant ponds of this like weird colored shit that looks like some alien planet shit. And that stuff never really goes away. So how is that picture better for the environment than a single oil well?
It's not. You see farms all over Ventura County. Lemons growing everywhere and an oil well.
Right next to it.
Like, their oil is so plentiful in California. Like, I used to live on the Sespe Creek, and there's a creek that comes into Sespe that's called Tar Creek. You want to know why it's called Tar Creek? Because there's oil just coming up out of the ground. Now, when I saw that, I was like, oh, my gosh, there's oil coming out of the ground. Yeah. And then I'm like, oh, there's oil coming out of the ground, because that's where oil comes from.
Rum, yes. Yes, that is where oil comes from. It comes from the ground.
And so why, and not to mention that we could be using all of our fryer oil to make diesel, easy peasy, yeah, lemon, yeah, squeezy, but yeah, we don't want to do that either. That's too much, like, right.
No.
But if we really cared, this is my thing. My conversation with those same people that would come up to you in the permaculture thing, if we really cared about the environment, why would we think a Tesla is better for the environment than my cows? Just explain it to me. Here's a picture of my cows. Here's a Tesla. Here's the mine that all the minerals had to come out of from the Tesla. Here's the coal mine that's making the power for your Tesla. Now explain to me how my cows are destroying the environment and your Tesla and saving the environment. Just explain it to me like I'm a baby. Nobody has an answer.
I get very angry.
Where's your Tesla going to go when it's all gone? Where's my cow going to go when it's all gone?
What are you or the next owner going to do when it's $18,000 to replace the battery pack in it and you don't have the money? And where's that battery pack when somebody does have the money that is expended going to go? Where's that going to go? What are those batteries made out of? What's inside of them? What plan is there to recycle them? There isn't one, by the way. But if you know of one, I don't know, tell me. When you ask questions like this, it makes people angry because it makes them reflect on the belief that they have. And the natural response to this is anger, because it is cognitive dissonance. There's multiple forms of cognitive dissonance, but this is the one most people that are familiar with and that is the information you're receiving is counter to what you believe. But there's also enough evidence that goes along with it to prove that it's true, but you can't accept it. And then the brain is literally in conflict. And so since I can't refute what you're saying with logic, facts, or reason, I'll make up some bullshit like, well, I just trust the experts, and I'll get angry. And it's almost like, I know this is crazy talk, it's almost like the people that are controlling everything are really smart about psychological interactions, and they want it that way. Like, that they might actually decide, like, we're going to plan and manage a society based on how human interaction works. And we have the best experts in the world to tell us so we can make decisions to put people in the greatest amount of conflict with each other so they don't look at us and we can get away whatever the fuck we want.
Yes, and that was my point about Elon Musk. Like, there's plenty of things to look at Elon Musk about.
Yeah.
But his awkward, I love you from my heart is not it. It's not it, guys. We're wasting your effort, your energy, your time on TikTok. Just stop.
So how would you, because we gotta wrap up. We're at 2.5 hours. It's crazy. That's fine. No, it's good conversation. What would be your advice be for people that are looking to start their own journey in regenerative farming, sustainable living? Like, at some point, like I always say, you got to jump. You got to go for it.
I would say two things. If you have the money and to buy some land and you want to sell your house and buy some land and just get on land and try. And then if you don't, I would go to like the Woofer website and sign up to go somewhere for 3 to 6 months, live in an RV and do, they, it's like free room and board, and you do 30 hours a week, and you'll learn so much, and you'll see what you want to do and you don't want to do. And you can even woof at different places. You know, you could do a month. We don't let anybody do less than 3 months here because we believe it's not enough time to really get immersed in what we're doing. And by the time you start being useful, your time to leave. Yeah. But we say 3 months or more. But you could even do, some places let you do a week, a month. But test out a bunch of different places. Test out some different climates. And along the way, you'll likely find a farm that is already doing something and they need help. And so once you find that place doing your woofer thing, I think that you can then see how can my skill set help this place. And then you make a proposal like, hey, I want to stay and I want to take on Sprouts, or I want to take on the farmer's market, or I want to take on whatever, and figure out a way to participate in community until you have an ability to get on your own land. But honestly, this my own is a PSYOP too. And there is no my own. I'm going to die and somebody else is going to own it and somebody else is going to own it. So we're all here for a finite amount of time, and you could be on land right now with people. And so don't get the my own. Don't let the my own get in the way. And because you're still, if it's my land and the deed is in my name, it's actually a bigger responsibility, harder for me. And you get to be here drinking the raw milk, eating the raw cheese, eating the vegetables, eating the beef, eating the pork, eating the lamb, eating the goat. I mean, that actually is a better deal for you, and no taxes, no mortgage. And so I think that go out into the woofer thing, sign up and start, you know, finding a place in the world. And
man, especially young people that are not tied to anything yet. How are you not taking this opportunity? This is what I'll put it. You could do it at any age, really, to a point anyway. It will never be easier for you than it will be for you to do it now. That's how, you know, I explain it to most people. Like, you have so much freedom when you're 22 years old, let's say. You don't know you have as much freedom as you. You think it all sucks and it's going to get better. And it's, some things can get better if you're on the right path, but you will never have that freedom again. When I got out of the military, I was 21 years old. And I was like, I realized I couldn't stand in line at the grocery store without getting angry because everybody did it wrong. Because I was used to everything being perfectly ordered and people knowing what to do. Even civilians, like your spouse, if you're married in the military, knows, like, you don't block the pass through, like, when the line's back up. Like, you put a gap. There's literally people run around yell at you and make you do it right. And I'm like, wait a minute. I can't expect everybody to be that way. I'm not in the military anymore. So I got on the Appalachian Trail in June, and I just walked until I got bored. I got to northern New Hampshire up near a place called North Conway. It took me about 3 months. I had a lot of stops in between. I had money saved up for my service and all, so I could go to hotels for a week before I go back on the trail. And I took that walk. I probably could do it today. My business would suffer, but I could do it. When I was working my ass off in corporate sales, running a division, raising a son, had a wife dependent on me, I couldn't have just walked away like that. And so if you're young and you can do the thing that you say you want to do, get doing it. Get stepping. Because life is going to, like I always say, like, you're either working toward more self-sufficiency, self-reliance, and liberty, or life is moving you backwards. So there's no static in this. You have to be actively engaged. And, man, you've had some great words for people today. You want to tell them how they can learn more about you?
Yeah, you could go to sovereignty ranch.com. You can buy meat or other products from us there. And if you ever want to come to the ranch, we have a restaurant open on the weekends. We have 40 beds if you want to come have a wedding, have a quinceañera, have a family reunion. And then I'm Chef Molly on Instagram. And then the restaurant for the ranch is Eat at the Barn on Instagram. And Sovereignty Ranch is also on Instagram. And we'd love you to follow along for our journey and come visit us here in Texas. And learn about regenerative agriculture.
And it's a beautiful part of the world where she's at too, guys. It's definitely worth making the trip. Molly, I'll make sure that links to all of those things and some other stuff that was sent in with your guest app are in the show notes today on the audio side. Folks, right down there in the video notes below this video, there's a link. You click that, you'll get over to the audio side, the blog with all of the resources on it. If you click it right this minute while we're live, it won't be there yet because we're not done yet. We're almost done. And Molly, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Sorry about my internet at the beginning. But
that's no big deal. We could hear you. That was the important part.
Excellent.
All right, guys, real quick, I'm going to wrap up fast because that one went long. I'm getting into like Joe Rogan territory here, almost 3 hours. But she was fantastic. And the free promo, when I put it out this morning, I told you this lady was fire. We probably could have went for another 3 hours. Absolutely awesome. Definitely check out her site. Check out what she's doing. I'm telling you, when I listen to her speak in Bastrop, I had no idea who she was. And I don't really get enamored with speakers a lot. You know, like, okay, we just hang out and do your thing and whatever at events. And I'm there more to talk to people. I was walking through and I stopped and I listened to her whole talk because I was just blown away by how much truth was pouring out. And we need people like this doing these things in the world. It's not the easy path, but it is the better path. There is a better way to do this. Maybe you've heard that somewhere before. Come on, let us show you the way. Anyway, before we wrap up real quick, I do want to let you know about my item of the day. I'm going to go really fast with it today. You guys know about it anyway. This was the number one selling item through T-Spaz last year, and I didn't bring it to you until around Thanksgiving. It is the Hamilton Beach 3-in-1 egg cooker. And, you know, I'm not a big gadget guy, really, but I don't like peeling fresh laid eggs. You have to let them sit around for a while or they don't want to peel right. This thing, it's like magic. You throw them in there, you turn it on, it stops, it beeps, you take them out, throw them in some ice water, and they peel like an orange. I mean, it just comes right off. It's just a wonderful tool. And they're only like $20. And in the write-up for this, if you haven't read it yet, I actually give a recipe away that's deviled eggs, but the deviled eggs are made with avocado instead of mayonnaise. And everybody that's tried them said that it's just awesome. So give my recipe a try, a little avocado, a little bacon, some other things. It's totally worth doing. And since we went so long, I'll just wrap up real quick today with you guys. I really appreciate everybody tuning in today. We had a lot of interaction in the live chat. If you've never made a live before, you can always find out the next upcoming live stream at tspclive.com, tspclive.com. You won't see a new one, though, until Monday next week. We do not live stream on Thursday because that's an expert council show. And that means we've got all this information being sent in from, like, I have like 15 people on the council. There's no way to manage that in a live stream. So tomorrow will be audio only. But if you want to make live streams, the best thing you can do is to sign up to be on the Telegram, either list or channel, or follow me on social. But Telegram, you know you'll get it every morning, usually about 2 hours before this. I put out what's going on that day and all the different streams. Most people watch us on YouTube. You can watch us on Rumble. You can watch us on Facebook. I don't ever go there, but I can click a button and it happens. In some other locations, you can watch us like Twitch. And I think there's like three of you guys over on Twitch. But Rumble and YouTube seem to be the ones that are most watched and most engaged with. And I don't really love YouTube's policies. I don't like Google at all. But when it comes to an interaction, I can interact with you guys really well if you're watching the YouTube stream because all your comments come into the back office. I'll catch you guys tomorrow with that Expert Council show. We'll do a Friday flashback and do it all again next week. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.